So if Ezekiel was here today, all right, you would call him anti-Semitic for rebuking you JJs for being imposters, okay? But he is here today, and he's in his lot. He's in his lot on the highways and byways preaching against you JJs and, of course, Babylon the Great.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 24th of November 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, the Arts Centre, on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores. The Aurora will do, not the Horizon, as I said the other week. Please don't use Google Play. They get you to give away all your DNA before you're allowed to download anything. And even then, it's only the rubbish you're allowed to download. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. So helping us navigate through the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, or the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour Party activist Martin Summers. Also, former Mayor of Bristol George Ferguson is joining us too. In the first part, we'll be looking at the Coomber Project in Hepburn Road. We'll be looking at some amazing changes that have been going on in the city, which is the closing down of the Colston Hall, the refurbishment of the Colston Hall, turning it into something called the Beacon Centre, costing lots of money. Is it worth it? And also the whole issue of slavery. But before he goes next May, is the mixed race mayor Marvin Rees going to do anything about the slavery legacy? Also, chaos and mass evictions at Barton House. £6 million being spent also by the City Council, apparently, to collect £3 million, according to Jeff Gollop from the Scrutiny Committee, from Bristol's working poor. So spending twice as much money than you're ever likely to get back from people with hardly any at all. What is going on? In part two, we'll be looking at the Dutch elections and the Argentinian elections. We've got Jungle Bus Millie from Holland talking about this new ex-journalist from Holland talking about the Geert Wilders and what does this all mean to have a new far-right government over in Holland, and the success or otherwise over there of their PR system. And then there's also Nazi hidey hole Argentina, some call it that anyway. I remember interviewing Lawrence DeMello and her talking about, oh yes, when I was first came over here in the 1970s, everyone was talking about the Nazis next door. Javier Milei in Argentina, and he's going to get the US dollar in as their currency. He's an anarcho-capitalist. Is Argentina going to be one of the first anarcho-capitalist countries in the world? Well, that would be an interesting one to see. Also on Gaza this week, a little bit of calm because of the temporary, what do they call it, humanitarian pause or something before they start killing, the killing machine going again. We'll be hearing this week from some of the great Jewish commentators, Gideon Levy and from Norman Finkelstein. Also, Iranian and Russian news has been banned in the UK, first by the telecom cartel, then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Anyway, welcome, George. George Ferguson, you're the former mayor of Bristol, famous for your red trousers, which you're always still wearing, even though, you know, you've finished being the mayor now. Can you just tell us a little bit about this Beacon Centre? Because that's been the big news across the city this week, the opening of the old Colston Hall, which is the city-owned concert hall, plus lots of other places there for events to take place, plays, all that sort of stuff. And it was, I think, only around about, and I'm guessing here, was it 2010? Or maybe, yeah, around about that time that it was refurbished before. Now it's been entirely refurbished, and it costs a lot more money this time.
Lots of money, £130 million. When I left office, it was going to be £50 million. So we're talking about £80 million overspend. That is staggering. I mean, we get 10% and 15% overspend often on public projects, but to get that level of overspend is quite extraordinary. And I'm afraid it is down to incompetence. Not incompetence by the Music Trust, I hasten to add. But
don't tell me you're a member of the Music Trust.
No, I'm not a member of the Music Trust. But I've got great admiration for Louise Mitchell, who runs it. I think it is down to the incompetence of the project management from the City Council. I mean, I'm an architect, as you know, and I've spent my life converting old buildings into new uses. And what you've got to do before you start a contract is establish what all the risks are. And that clearly wasn't done. And you need to dig deep and find out where the structural faults are, what's underneath the building. And I gather that was all very, very perfunctory. And we're paying the price. So there was an open contract. The contractors just ran circles around the City Council project management, who wouldn't say boo to a goose. And we are paying the price. The irony is, to me, that Marvin, who, you know, I've got a lot of time for Marvin in many ways. I don't like to attack him. But I think rather spitefully cancelled the Central Arena, which was the obvious thing to do, to put an arena at the biggest transport hub in the southwest. He cancelled that at huge cost to the city, a huge waste. That arena that would have held 12,000 people would have cost the city less because of the loss of grant that we had. It would have cost the city less than the conversion of the old Colston Hall, the Beacon, the Bristol Beacon, which will house less than 2,000 people. So there is a real irony there, and I'm afraid Bristol people will be paying the price forever because that will never be repaid, unlike in the arena where it would have been repaid over 20 or 25 years.
Okay, look, is it the Bristol City Council job to be running entertainment venues when they can't even keep the lights on or get the bins emptied?
I think it's City Council's job to run cultural venues. I don't think we've been very good at culture in recent years. The Arts Council has rather abandoned Bristol in many cases because it has not seen the city investing enough in all our cultural organisations. We've got loads and loads of brilliant people who do things in this city. And with small grants, you can make a huge difference. I'm afraid those grants have generally been diverted into this money pit. And I think the result is a good result. So let's hope that in 20 years' time, people feel that it was worthwhile. But when the cost is forgotten, but the quality is remembered. But I do think it is a shocking misuse of money, but I don't think it's the wrong project. I think it was just very, very badly
handled. So £93 million, some people say. You're saying more than that.
I'm saying it's 130 million.
130.
Yeah. And when I left office, I put 10 million into it from the City Council, and that was meant to be enough. And the rest came from Arts Council and other funding. So actually, the expenditure by the City Council is multiplied by a factor of 8.
Well, this is, you know, it's pretty amazing, really, pretty shocking. Is that money that could have been spent on doing things like keeping public toilets open, fixing light bulbs in street lamps, making sure the pavements aren't all cracked as the trees grow up or big lorries go over them?
No, it's mainly capital funding. It will have been disguised by flogging off various bits of council land and property in order to pay for it. I don't know exactly how it's been funded, but it's capital rather than revenue funding. So it has prevented other things being done. But it certainly hasn't. It shouldn't impact on the revenue budget, other than the fact that the borrowing costs will, then that's when capital becomes revenue, when you have continuing borrowing costs. And borrowing, as we know, is not cheap now.
Well, this is one of the reasons Marvin Rees, the new mayor that took over from you, George, one of the reasons that he said he wanted to cancel the project you put together for Temple Meads, because the council was going to be borrowing far too much money. He was on the record this week being interviewed by someone on Twitter saying, actually, look, we first thing that happened would have happened once the arena was open, that we had a whole load of pandemic, and the place would not have been able to make any money. So the council would have had to foot the bill. And, you know, he didn't want to saddle the city with so much debt. I mean, there's some wisdom to that, surely.
No. I think that is an amazing bit of hindsight. I mean, how could I have known the pandemic was coming? And in any case, by then we would have done a contract with the operators, and it would have been, either of the operators would have taken the hit, or it would have been a shared hit with the city council.
Okay, but with the cost of living crisis, if you want to call it that, you could call it a slump, a recession, or whatever. How can you guarantee that, you know, you're going to be able to pay that money back? The council, surely, you know, this is a bit like a council buying up things like shopping centres and making investments that surely business should be making, and to saddle the city with debt into the future is storing up problems for the next generation. I mean, this is obviously what central government's been doing, you know, building up massive debts for the future and thinking, well, as long as we get what we want done in our time, it doesn't matter.
Well, I've had the good fortune of spending my life dealing with planning and property and things like that as an architect and personally, and so I understand the way these finances work. I did quite a lot of purchasing for the city, particularly around the station, not just for the arena, but for other things. And as a result of that, we built up a huge and valuable land bank. And we sold some of that on to the university at a profit to the city. So I think it is right the city gets involved in a certain amount of dealing, but it's got to do it with wisdom and good advice. And I'm afraid it's been done rather in a cavalier manner in recent times.
The university, the people that have moved in, and legal and general, into Temple Island, which is where the arena, where you wanted, and I think most of Bristol wanted the arena to go. So what's the significance of the... It seems that the university have sort of said, well, actually, we're more important, we're more powerful. We want to take over this piece of land. It's much more useful to us than it is to a whole bunch of people that want to go and see Adele or, you know, whoever it happens to be playing there.
Well, I think the university is very important to the whole economy of the city and to the culture of the city, and I think we benefit from having a lot of students in the city. Not that everybody who lives next to them will always agree with that, but I think in many respects that the university students contribute positively to the city with volunteering and many other things. So I'm not going to knock the university, and I think the university expanding into the Temple Meads campus makes a lot of sense. I suppose I declare an interest there. I'm on the university court, and I'm a triple graduate of the university.
So what do you do? Yeah. You put professors in prison. What does the university court do?
I try and defend professors from going from being done over and being sacked for stating their point of view, because I think it's vitally important that that teaching staff at the university should be free to state their learned opinions. Of course, they shouldn't be free to be racist, and that is not in any case that I know of in recent times, the university. But the university is petrified of this whole issue of anti-Semitism, and quite rightly so. But they misinterpret what anti-Semitism is. Supporting Palestine, knocking Zionist organizations that are extremely powerful and have great influence on our politicians and business is not being anti-Semitic. And I mean, I have Jewish heritage, and so I think I'm entitled to say this. And I think it's quite wrong of the university to have sacked a professor who is extremely serious at what he does, because he reveals what's going on, and that is what academics should be doing.
Well, we're talking here about, in the background, between the lines, if you want to listen to about a guy called Professor David Miller, or Dr. David Miller. We can't really say too much about what's going on with that, because there is a tribunal going on at the moment, but we'll certainly be letting you know what happens once that's been decided. Yeah, he was a sociology professor who was sacked for alleged anti-Semitism, and he's now fighting over the last few weeks through the employment tribunal to get compensation. I mean, the employment tribunal, in theory, George, can say you've got to get the university have got to give you your job back. In theory, they can say.
In theory, they will. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure a judge will be fair. It's not a jury. I'm sure a judge will take all the facts into account. It will be very interesting to see what comes out of it.
It certainly will. And also, we're joined in the studio by Sister Nwani. Hi, Sister.
Hi. Evening. Everybody.
Good evening. Sister Nwani's been one of the people helping run the Kumba Centre over the last few years. But before we talk about the Kumba Centre, I'd like to just say something about Barton House, because this has been in the national news over the last few weeks. And we had... Bushra Ali last week on the programme saying, oh, he's been putting people up in his house who were homeless. Some people have been sleeping in their cars. Others have refused to leave Barton House. George, do you just want to explain, how can a council just mass evict an entire tower block of 400 people in this? Actually, they haven't taken anybody to court through the courts. They've just turned up and said, right, everybody out.
Well, they regarded it as an emergency. I don't have all the facts. As you know, I'll repeat it, I'm an architect. I take great interest in the structure of buildings. I hate these blocks of flats that people are forced to live in. I don't think it's a very good way of creating good community. I think we can create the densities that required in a much more civilized manner. And so Barton House is a very dramatic illustration of the unsatisfactory nature of these buildings. But you may not remember, but at the end of the 60s, or maybe it was the early 70s, Ronan Point was a building that was built at the same time as Barton House, and with the same method, with large panel construction. And the large panels are not properly fixed to each other. So if there's an explosion in one of the flats, a gas explosion, and there's pressure builds up in that flat, the outer wall will tip out, and then the floor above it, which is another panel, will simply fall down and squash the people underneath. You can get a domino effect going down the corner of the building.
I don't mean to be an idiot, but surely there's reinforced steel bars right the way through this place holding up the concrete, aren't there?
There are bolts, there are brackets, there are not reinforced steel bars connecting the panels, as far as I understand. But, I mean, this building has been standing for 65 years or something. And, suddenly to panic like that is, to my mind, is the wrong thing to do. I think it would be more sensible to have waited for a few days, because you've got to put one risk against another risk. There is a huge risk in terms of health, both mental and physical health, of suddenly moving people out without warning. And you've got to balance that against the very, very unlikely risk that within days the building is going to have a collapse. And so I think I understand why councillors panic over things like this, but I think the risk is so minimal, and I think there was a much greater risk, and I think we're seeing it now, of the upset of people by suddenly tipping them out rather than giving it enough time to give proper consideration to how it was done. I mean, what was absolutely appalling is there was a press release about the emptying the building before the people inside the building knew about it.
Well, this is one of the ways that this city council, in a kind of corporate fashion, seems to try and manage public opinion, is through the press, not by speaking to people who are actually even involved in it. Anyway, Sister Nwani, I wonder if you have come across anybody who's been displaced from Barton House, or what you make of what's happened there. I mean, people I've spoken to connected with it are saying, well, actually, they started off by saying, we want you to leave. You can come back in 2 or 3 days. They're now saying 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe in 2 or 3 weeks' time, they'll be saying 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, good evening, listeners. I'm Sissi Nwani from St. Paul's and also managing the Kumba Centre. But like everybody else, I was appalled when I heard about the Barton Hill. I haven't got any take on it at the moment. I'm just, awe of the amount of people that were asked suddenly to vacate and were shuttled into hotels and so forth. And it's really a huge impact on family life, really. And it begs the question, in terms of what you were just discussing, was that an early move? Was that a premature move? Should they have waited and really assessed the situation correctly before? I mean, that's a lot of people to move out at one time. So, you know, I'm just like everybody else, just shocked.
Yeah.
What I mean, think is
60
wonderful.
Years. It stood there for 60 years. And it nothing's fallen off it yet.
No, and, you know, the likelihood that it would that week is about, it's probably less likely than Hinkley Point exploding, you know. I mean, it's
that might be more.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is ridiculous. But what I do find encouraging is the community reaction to it. I mean, I think that's heartening. Yeah. You know, the Cafe Conscious, and is she called Dina? I can't remember. I mean, it's just wonderful the way people rally round. And this is a good city, not because of its leadership. I used to say that when I was mayor. It's a good city because it's got so many people with a good heart that come in and help in situations like this. And local businesses have been giving money to help the people. And at the same time, the city council has said that it's going to carry on charging them rent.
Yeah.
Hang on, that's absurd, isn't it? Well, anyway, let's have a listen now to we'll hear from Martin Summers in a minute. But before that, we'll just hear from the mayor hear an ITV report. I think it's ITV, maybe Points West report on Barton House. When the mayor returned from his excursion, I think he's off again now to Dubai. He seems to spend more time out of Bristol than he does in. This is when he'd just come back from Rwanda this week.
With no warning, the people of Barton House were told their homes weren't safe and to leave immediately. 3 days in, the shock has become exhaustion, frustration and anger. Here at City Hall, the community came back together today to try to get their voices heard.
We're here today to push for answers. You know, we want to know what's happening. We want to know, are the residents of the other blocks safe? And we want to know what they're going to do for the 400 people that have been kicked out already.
There are people in emergency accommodation across Bristol in hotels and B&Bs. Anne Fisher is staying with a friend. She's lived at Barton House for 30 years.
Also, I was told, get out, the block's in danger, it's going to come down. So I had to grab what I could. My husband died 2 years ago, so my life is in that flat. If I lose that, I can't replace him. And I can't replace the things that he brought me. So if that comes down, I've lost everything.
This morning, the City Hall has been filled with residents of Barton House and surrounding tower blocks in Bristol. And there have been powerful and emotional testimony from people who have been evicted from their homes. Protest has now finished and residents have quickly left the City Hall because they've been told there's activity at Barton House and they are fearing for their possessions. We got here and found that their fears weren't realised, but there was so much confusion, including from Yasmin. She's living in a hotel in the city centre with her one-year-old son.
Over 400 people in that block. Over half our kids. There's vulnerable kids. My son's 1 year old. At least half of the residents, you know, they have some kind of vulnerability to them. It's ridiculous. And we're being placed all over Bristol. What do we do? We've been booked in until Monday. What do we do after Monday? We don't want to go back into our flats. We're petrified. We're all petrified. We do not know. We're all basically homeless right now. We need to stand our ground. Bristol City Council, you need to sort your act out. It's ridiculous.
Marie Lennon reporting there. Well, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees was overseas on business when the residents of Barton House were evacuated earlier this week, but he's now returned to Bristol and is involved in the council's response to the crisis. Earlier, we spoke to him outside City Hall and he explained how long it could take to find out the true extent of the problems.
We had an investigation done into Barton House because it is the oldest block we have in the city. So we did an piece of investigation to find out what we should do with it in the future. As we were revamping all of our public housing stock in the city, what should we do with Barton House? So that was just about looking at the state of the building. What it then found was those more fundamental challenges. And when we had the conversation with the fire service on Tuesday morning, we agreed that an evacuation was proportionate to the scale of risk that we had identified. As long as we don't get any interruptions to the work that needs to be done now, we'll get the next round of survey results in around 2 weeks. That will then tell us whether people can actually move back into the house or whether the house, whether Barton House is actually unsafe. At the same time, we are obviously right now looking at what we would do for that permanent accommodation if people are unable to return. Decanting people from a whole tower block in a city is not what we want to do, and certainly not just before the holiday season, you know, as well. We do it because the evidence tells us that the building is not safe. And, you know, extreme events seem incredibly unlikely until they happen. But we've no evidence to suggest any blocks in the city, you know, are structurally unsound in a way that Barton House was found to be.
Well, it sounds to me like it was the fire brigade, George. Oh, I mean, you know, it's very difficult to figure out what's going on. I tend to be a bit suspicious and cynical, as you know. And I wonder if maybe, if it looks as if everyone's been cleared out of there, rehoused somewhere else, that this may be worth money. It may be refurbished, it may be redeveloped, this building. I've seen the same happen in London.
Yeah, to be honest, I doubt that's the case, Tony. But I understand, you know, I understand that people are going to be suspicious. No, I think the case is that the fire brigade did do an inspection and reported that they were concerned that if there was any form of explosion that that you might get a Ronan Point type domino collapse. Yeah, I can only repeat that that is so unlikely. Well,
let's get Martin Summers in here. Martin, I've never heard ever of a case where we're being told that people are being evicted, but they still have to pay rent.
Well, I think that's a bit extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, that definitely demands some explanation. If you're going to evict people, you can hardly demand rent from them, can you? It doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, obviously, like everybody else, I'm just playing catch-up and trying to find out what's happening here. But it does strike me as very odd that you should do something like this at such short notice. Surely you should have been assessing this. This has been a problem for years. It's the oldest council block in Bristol. It's obviously the most vulnerable, and you should have thought that they'd have some kind of management plan for it, but apparently not.
So the mayor of Bristol has confirmed that residents, to make it clear to residents, that in principle the council will be charging rent for those evacuated. Anyway, talking about evictions, we cannot talk about Coomber. Sister Nwani, can you just tell us a little bit about what Coomber is for the listeners that have never heard about you?
Yeah, it's Coomber's a long-established community building in St. Paul's from 1974. It was given to the first ethnic group of people, namely the Rastafarians, and it went through development in the early 90s and became a community centre doing training and employment, and it's moved from there to the African arts across the southwest, really. That's what Coomber stands for. That's the history, that's the legacy of that venue.
Okay, so is it exclusively West Indian?
Initially, when it started, it was, but it's changed with time, really, than anything else. People wanting to better themselves, employment, education. The Southwest Arts was specifically looking at black arts, so that was specifically Afro-Caribbean. We took over Coomber in 2010, and we took that. Well, we didn't take it away. It lost its funding at the time. We sat and we had a discussion, and we felt we wanted Coomber to represent the changes also in the local community, and we just wanted to call it a community centre.
Okay, so its actual building is owned by the council. So what's been the relationship with the council like? Or most of it is, anyway.
I'll just say kind of we're all right with the council until this whole situation started.
So, okay, how did it start? When were there first rumblings that the council weren't happy with the way the building's being managed and run?
Last year, April 22, they came in on a so-called health and safety check for the building. We allowed them to come in, wasn't a problem. We kind of welcome it. We haven't seen the council for over 7 years in the building, so that was fine. So they came in. Obviously, there's one or two things they felt we could do. They listed it. let's say it was a list of 10 points. We addressed very quickly 8 of the points, and then we held off on the other two, largely to do with income, having to pay for a couple of things that they wanted to have done. And Cumber, under our management, is self-reliant. It doesn't get any funding from 2010. We don't get any grants from the council or anybody else. We're self-reliant. We generate money from renting the units and bookings and so forth. So 2010, 2022, when we had a letter in October, we figured it was about the health and safety check, but the letter actually said, because we were dissolved the charity status in 2019, and we didn't understand the impact of what that would be, because we didn't have any initial governance from the previous or from the council how the building should be managed. We were quite shocked with that, but anyway, they seemed to take it quite serious and just decided in October, instead of finishing off the health and safety dialogue, went straight into your trespassers.
Trespassers?
Yeah.
So what do they... I mean, I think one of the things that sounds to me as if it's kind of at the nub of this is getting the building up to... You're saying there's a couple of things that they said on health and safety that hadn't been got up to scratch.
Well, they suggested that we should do, like, the water, the Legionnaires check. We should check the water, which said was fine. They asked them for electrical overhaul, and we were already in the process of doing our annual inspection, so we stopped because we weren't sure what was going on with the council. I think that was it. The minor things were like, have you got building insurance, good liability, who's your health and safety, all the minor stuff we were able to tick that box.
So surely, I mean, this is a discussion that should have been going on between maybe the Deputy Mayor, Asher Craig, or the Mayor, Marvin Rees, and you, which the council officers would then implement. So a negotiation between the Mayor and the people running the building, i.e. you, to be sorted out through the council officers. So what happened? What's been going on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not negative to or oblivious to the community and community development, because all my track record of employment have always been in the inner city working.
Is this a section of the council, community development?
Yeah. Yeah, they have a department. And I've been involved in the another community centre, and we've had community development support on issues there. So with the Cumber Centre, one would expect there's a table discussion rather than what angle they've taken with us at the moment.
Well, as I understand it, with big companies and countries, if you're going to a legal dispute, that's because all negotiations have broken down. But it doesn't sound as if there's been much in the way of negotiation. Now, I'm sure the council will say, well, we've tried to negotiate with the Cumber, we've found it impossible.
Yeah, I mean, again, you would say to yourself, what's the definition of negotiation? It comes in different forms. And for me as a community worker, I would like something like this, a table discussion where we can see who we're talking to. We can raise the issues. If we're lacking understanding round the table, you could see that, you can explain. We didn't get that. From October, we just got a letter, and they kept the letters coming saying, you haven't answered our questions. We're thinking, we've answered all your questions. What more? We kept saying, we've answered your questions, but we would like a table discussion. So every letter they sent us, our letters would always end saying, we're sorry that you don't want to meet with us, but we still would like to meet with you.
Does sound as if you're willing to meet with them, but they're not willing to meet with you. I mean, we are in a situation, aren't we, with the Mayor Marvin Rees and probably the Deputy Mayor Asher Craig too, at the Mayor's office. They are on their way out. I mean, they're really necessary. Marvin isn't going to be standing again. I wonder if he's really committed to sorting out problems like this. Maybe he's thinking more about what he's going to be doing after he finishes as mayor. But anyway, George, what do you make of this whole process where something actually a very important part of the city, which was put there in the 1970s as a resource for the West Indian community, particularly Rastafarians at that time, is now, the council are now dealing with it in this way, almost basically through their legal services department, sending them legal letters.
It does seem clumsy again, and I think it's just a sign of control freakery, I think, that the council, it's similar to the bear pit the council want to have control of these things. And I've always felt that actually you get much better, you get much more out of people if you give them the responsibility and allow them to get on with things that are about their own community. You know, so good leadership to me is giving permission. But this seems to be exactly the opposite. I've known Quumba for many years. I mean, off, on and off, and I've been to events there, which, and it's a great space for St. Paul's and the and the community. Wasn't it? I used to go to, they had dominoes. They have dominoes there. It was always great fun, and the slapping of dominoes on the tables. And a colleague of mine did the conversion of it many, many years ago. So I cannot see what the council on are on about other than this wanting control of everything instead of allowing people to do their own thing.
Well, hang on, because there was a similar thing in a way that happened whilst you were mayor, George, and that was the carnival. You stepped in and you said, actually, the people running the carnival, which is obviously a very important West Indian tradition in the city, it's something we all love. People come from all over the country too, but you didn't think that they were capable of doing it. So I wonder if we can make some sort of comparisons between, you know, Marvin and Asher's actions and yours back on the carnival in those days.
Well, maybe you can, but I think there was real reason for that, because the carnival did get into quite a dangerous situation. I think the carnival is brilliantly run now, and I've written about it and said that, you know, if only all our big events could be run more like the carnival that has a bit of leeway. You know, you compare the carnival to what the disaster that was the Harbour Festival, for instance, which was very control freakery, where people were corralled into these fenced areas that were nothing to do with the harbour. I didn't, you know, that happened just after St. Paul's. But I went down to the St. Paul's Carnival and just thought it was great. I mean, I don't know that everybody who lives in St. Paul's thinks it's great, but it had a wonderful atmosphere and a sense of freedom. And there was, you know, there was no real trouble. When I interfered, there had been some very real trouble. I mean, you know, some very nasty crime, but that's not the fault of the festival, but I think it did need reviewing.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, in terms of, the Quumba Centre, I think what people need to understand here, the council don't want the building back. They want people out. They want the board out. That's what the situation is. That's clearly documented. So I'm not saying anything that I'm not supposed to talk about. Mm. It's something that they've written in their letters. It's something that they've written to the unit holders, who are our clientele. We brought them there. They're telling the unit holders that you're okay. But Quumba Project, that's us, the board, has not left. And we'll go to court, which is where we are now. So I'm trying to be careful about what I'm saying. But we are now in the courtroom with this issue that I believe could have been dealt with round the table.
Yeah, I think there has to be the political will to do that. Marvin has to want to come and sit down with you and talk it through face to face, I think. And he doesn't seem to want to do that. He's got more important. He's gone off to Dubai. He's in, God knows, Kigali or wherever. Yeah. He's got very much more important things to do than look after the West Indian community in St. Paul's.
There should never be good reason for refusing to sit around the table.
Well,
I just think that is... you know, I'm not saying that of Marvin. I'm just saying that whoever it is, I regard that as a very arrogant attitude, that you're not prepared. Or maybe it's a slightly scared attitude. They just don't want to have that conversation.
But why not? The centre is run by the community, as you said early on. Quumba is an early day asset.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was given to the community in the 70s to manage. Yeah. We've been managing it for 10 years, self-reliant. Yes, we're not. None of us up there are getting a salary.
Yeah? No.
None of us up there are getting a salary. We've got it full house. There's no space for you to rent except the hall and the meeting room. So this thing around, we're not doing anything in Cumber, or Cumber's not doing anything. It's a misinterpretation that's really affecting Cumber.
Well,
right,
you know what?
Now,
I think in a way this is bullying. It's like your face doesn't fit, Sister Nwali.
Exactly. I mean, I'm trying not to get to say the personal side of this whole situation on the air, but that is the known fact to everybody in the community. This is not about the Cumber Centre. This is about you.
Yeah.
What is it about me? Oh, I've forgotten. We don't really.
You're not
on.
Qualified. We don't. Something like on. That. You haven't ticked the right boxes.
I just don't get on with one and two people. At
well, that's so wrong. That's so. That is so wrong.
I'd just like to say something about
should
the
be judged
centre,
on its merit,
you know, as a local resident that pops in there from time to time. It's an absolutely lovely environment in there. You meet all sorts of people.
That's great.
There's no like sort of CCTV cameras scanning you as you're coming in. You know, a security guard checking your blood group or whatever it is. It's a very open and it's a very actually a very West Indian zone.
Yeah, it's still West Indian orientated, but it is very much community. We get loads of people who come in there and say, oh, I've never been here before. Oh, people are so nice in here. And they're actually white people, younger generation.
Yeah.
It's really comfortable here. I just feel like I can be myself in here. So to me, that's a joy in the community. Yes, we know the legacy.
Well, this is what
history.
We stand to lose, right? So when we had that big public meeting you organised, about 6 or 8 weeks ago, the place was packed. There was a commitment from the audience. We're going to defend this place. Absolutely. And we're going to defend you. Actually, that's like hundreds, a couple of hundred people behind you basically saying, let the council try.
And that's exactly what we did in the end. We were told not to leave. The letters say go. The community, for the first time, we've had a public meeting, which was over 100 people. And I would say 95%, if not 98%, said stay. And that's what we're doing.
Anyway, so what's been going on this week? Because you were in court, weren't you? Or you were nearly in court on Monday down at the Civil Justice Centre.
Yeah, we've been fortunate to, and again, I have to be careful, we've got legal support. And they were able to intervene, and the case was vacated and set back for a later date, which will give Cumber, although I believe we have it, the chance to prepare a strong defence on the issues. I can't say, I know what was said.
Well, I had a peep at some of the court papers, and the first paragraph of the court papers was just factually inaccurate. I mean, I don't know if this is, maybe Bristol Legal Services aren't quite up to scratch, George.
Well, I'm not going to blame officers. I don't know whether this is instigated by officers or by the politicians, but I think that it is just a fundamental failing not to talk it through. And, you know...
Well, George, the word trespasses, that alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know, everybody knows what that... We all looked it up, but we all know what it means. And we're saying that's not us.
No.
If you want to call us something else and get a reason to get us out of the building, call us something else. Well, we've been there for 13 years.
Yeah.
Sister Nwani's got the community behind her. I mean, you know, not just me. Yeah. It's a whole load of us. So what's your advice to her?
I think put pressure on, gentle pressure, on a wider body of councillors to interfere with this rather than just dealing with the one or two that are driving this.
But who? We have local Ashley councillors.
Amira Cole won't
get involved.
Yeah, well, Amira Cole's...
Neither of the Ashley councillors get involved.
Yeah, three of them. And they're all pretty much as one. Oh, well, I think probably the council's probably right here. That's their take.
Well, that's sad. I would have thought that the councillors would see the benefit at least of having a proper conversation.
That's right, there's an election coming along, folks, you know. Mm. Martin, do you want to just say something about this? It's been a whole interesting, for us anyway, as a local residents, to see, it's almost like some people from afar have come into St Paul's and they're trying to close down the very thing that makes it a great place to live.
Well, I just want to make a comment, really, because obviously I'm listening. I know people around the table know more about this than I do. But there is an election coming up in May. Now, what is the political affiliation of the three councils in
this? Two Greens and a Labour, Amira Cole's Labour, but she supports the council.
Yes, but I would have thought that this should be an issue for the Greens if they want to take control of Bristol City Council. They can say, well, we're going to oppose the decisions of the current Labour Council. Vote for us come May, and that's what we're about. I mean, that's what elections are for.
Absolutely.
That's all I'll say.
I think the Labour councillors would be concerned if they found that the Greens were taking a much more conciliatory approach to this.
In the meantime, can you just tell us a bit about what's going on over the next couple of weeks at Coomber? You know, the sort of events you're holding.
Well, coming out of there, since the case was set back, we were discussing again, what do we do? Because we've been kind of stagnant, and we've been told to just carry on as normal. So yesterday I put out a shout to the unit holders and to other people in the community that Coomber's open as normal. And we've lost a significant amount of income over the last year and a half.
And time,
because we haven't been able to do anything. Our premises license was taken away. Everything was stopped with the council. So we're playing by compliance at the moment, which means anything we do down there finishes by 11. All our best income coming in for an income-generated group is usually when we hire out the building and go up to at least 1 o'clock, if need be. We can't do that anymore.
Has there been any pressure, do you think, from local residents on the council?
Yeah, you are right next to a whole load of residential streets, aren't you? I mean, you do have gigs on in there.
Yeah, they're just shocked. Everybody, the majority of people that I've spoken to about Coomber, they're like, what? What are you talking about? You know, because we're not a disorderly group as a management group. Actually, we're quite nice.
We
take care of the street. Sometimes we sweep the road. If there's an event, great. We go out, we pick up the bottles.
Marvin down to give you a hand.
Well, I seen him there once, but it wasn't to us he came to. But I try not to call Marvin or Asher's name because I know they feel it's about, I'm saying it's about them, but they know what the situation is. You failed to come and talk to us. You don't want to talk to us, yeah? We're sitting there just waiting. Now we're in court. Why? We don't
so
need
wrong.
To go to court.
So it's like a bad divorce, isn't it? And, you know,
that building and the people in there, especially the volunteers, when there was a heavy drugs activity on Hepburn Road, our people on the inside of Hepburn Road, the youngers, went out and shifted the guys and say, look, especially my son was there, and he said, look, my mom's here. You can't be coming down here. And they just moved. They just moved. So we're quite good. We're more than just community people in the building. We serve the community because we live here. I'm historical with Coomber. I know what it stood for, and I want it to benefit other people. I don't want to hold on to it. I'm not trying to hold on to it. I'm ready to move on. But when you say move on to who? There has to be a process. And the council need to understand, when we took over, there was an issue. The building was momentarily left vacant. And we got in there quick time. And we were met with the lady who was managing the building. She came in and she sat with us for about 3 months. This time round, nobody wants to sit with us. No one wants to talk to us. Just out. Well, it's not happening.
It's a whole sort of aloofness, George, a sort of distance. This council, it's almost as if it's on the moon.
Well, I'm puzzled about it. I do think it's very strange. I mean, what you made me do is go and find out more and talk to some of the councillors and see what's going on. I mean, I don't have any official say in this, but I do know some of the people involved, so I will, you know, I will certainly
I don't want to labour the point over Coomber, but there is this whole issue of slavery, isn't there, that when Marvin Rees became mayor as a mixed-race mayor, Bristol's first, there was a bit of pressure on him saying, look, we've got a big, big slavery legacy here in Bristol. There was a campaign for quite a while to get some sort of exhibition centre to do with slavery. Of course, we had the whole, well, it was like world news shattering business of Edward Colston's statue being chucked into the floating harbour, and even other actions around the world, people seeing this and thinking, yeah, there's someone else I'd like to do that to. What do you make of the Marvin's record with the legacy of slavery? Because Bristol was involved in it, and it just seems important to make sure that, you know, we should be remembering the facts, Bristol's involvement, but also maybe looking at today and things like modern slavery, even maybe wage slavery, where people simply cannot afford to eat.
I mean, I think it was fortunate for Bristol that it had a black mayor at the time, and I think Marvin came out quite well from it, to be honest. I think, you know, what would I have done? It it's always difficult to know, but I think I would have been at a severe disadvantage compared with Marvin, being a middle-class white man, or middle-aged or old white man, than being the black mare that Marvin is. So I think, you know, I'll hand it to him. I think that's one of the best things he did. Of course, you can criticize some of it. I think it's a shame we're not using the plinth of the Colston plinths in a creative way. I think it's an opportunity.
What did Marvin do? I mean, it wasn't Marvin. It was a demonstration. It was a Black Lives Matter.
No, the demonstration. I'm not talking about the demonstration. I think, you know, the aftermath of it, the fact that the Colston statue is now housed in the museum, that it has been used as an educational tool, the fact that we have now, and you know, that was in process, that we've now changed the names of the Colston Hall to the Beacon and other things like that. I would find it difficult to criticise him about that.
Sister Nuani,
I certainly wouldn't, when you talk about slavery and what that stands for, because coming back to the situation with Kumba, and it's documented in the council's letter, and everybody knows in the community, they said to take this black board management committee out and put another black group in. And the community is saying, what black group? Why do you want to divide us? That sounds like the postcode war that's going on with our young people.
Does.
Black people, you know, the council, for me, how can you, how dare you actually say in writing, we want to take one black group out and we want to tender the building to the black community? That to me is just so wrong. It really squashes everything we've done as the current management committee in terms of equalities and developing a space that still has the legacy. It's still being black managed, but it's open to the community.
Yeah,
I don't get that at all.
It's clear sign of wanting our people running it rather than
exactly.
Yeah, it want yes. our yeah. yeah. And I think that's really unfortunate. And
when you're in the council house as a politician, and that's your mentality, yeah. and it's out there, then to me, I question whether or not you're fit enough to represent the people with that kind of mindset. Because you're creating division.
Yeah, I think that's really, the people. Really, that's, really
that should
unfortunate.
Go to the whole cabinet.
Yeah. Yeah.
They should be aware of this is actually happening in St. Paul's.
Absolutely.
Some of your officers, so I'm not blaming the whole cabinet. Mm. I'm not even saying Asher and Marvin, they know who it is. Mm. I'm not even saying the whole council. I'm saying the asset team. Because yeah. they're the drivers of this situation. You understand? I've got nothing to fear. Some people might say, when you talk, you could affect your case or whatever you're doing. No, it's not about that. I'm going to court for the truth.
Yeah.
I want to be heard. Yeah, I'm being told to tone down a bit. Tone down what? I don't need to tone down. You've toned me down. I've been in Kumba for 13 years and I've been there before that. Mm. I've been running that building self-reliant. I sweep up, I clean, I do whatever. I'm not complaining. But now you're telling me I must go? Listen, 400 years we've been here. This is not the person you tell to go.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sounds to me like you just got hired. You're the right person for the job. You fit all the criteria. And it worries me that the council is sitting there thinking, well, actually, we're going to have a few secret interviews and we want this one, this one, this one, this one. And we're not going to tell anybody who they are.
Well,
anyway, look, both of you, if there's some sort of campaign website or anything like that, Sister Nuani, that people can find, that can follow what you're doing. I mean, I've actually been reporting on it quite well in the Bristol Post.
Yeah. The nicest thing, again, with us down there, we weren't trying to strum up a witch hunt with the council. You know why? Because we feel we haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
We're in truth. Yeah, so there is nothing. There isn't no campaign. All I do know is if we go to court, there'd be a lot of people down there. You understand?
Yeah.
Because people are just saying it's just wrong. It's just unfair.
Yeah.
The truth must prevail.
And isn't it funny that at the same time we've had the people getting around a table over in Qatar over the Gaza killings and some sort of negotiation happening and a peace slowly maybe coming to that horrible situation out in the Middle East. Why can't we do it here in Bristol? Just sit around a table, talk things through.
This is slightly people easier dynamics. Too.
People dynamics. Yeah. We're not the first. There's been known cases in Bristol. The recent one was the farm that was under threat of closure. they negotiate, and it's all right. So what's wrong with Cumber?
Yeah,
yeah. They have also been.
What's wrong with Cumber?
There is also a threat to the Rastafarian Centre, wasn't there, on Grosvenor Road? And everyone was scratching their what's going on here. And am I right in saying that the council pulled back on that?
Well, it's resolved.
Good. Well, that's the
it's resolved. That's all I'm hearing. Yeah. It's resolved.
Anyway, I think there's nothing worse than dividing communities. We should be doing everything we can
maybe we
to try and pull them together.
Not pay our council tax until they get their head screwed on. Anyway, look, both George Ferguson and Sister Nwani from Cumber Project, thanks very much for joining us. So that is from 1995. Really should have been playing Dr. Alimentado there, shouldn't I? You know, anyone that knows a bit about reggae will know and love him. So that was De Lacy and Hideaway from 1995. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with our Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And now I'm joined by Dr. Judith Brown, who's been doing special studies on all sorts of things. She worked in Yemen for a long time for the United Nations, and also, well, I don't know how long for, but has been recently doing a whole load of research on the whole fake news industry. And you came up here to Bristol to do a little talk about it, Judith. But can you just give us an idea of where this industry sprung from? Because I think it's something that we kind of assume. Most of us will see this either on the television with somebody like Mariana Spring popping up and saying, oh, we've had a good old look at this and we'll tell you what really happened. This is what really transpired. Yeah. And also on social media, Twitter, Facebook, things like that, if the fake news people don't agree with you, they will either ban you or they'll put a sort of little screen up over it, in an Orwellian screen, saying, oh, we think you probably won't want to have a look at this because it's inaccurate. So where did this industry come from?
Well, I think that, as you know, Tony, the news is, there's lots of literature and research showing that the news is sort of in hock to governments. They have a lot of the mainstream news over many years has been strongly influenced by governments and people of the wealthy companies and things like this.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So actually, governments, yeah, although they're doing the regulation, they're often in hock to the banks and to the big business, aren't
indeed
they?
Indeed they are. And then I think with the advent of social media, which I think was at the beginning of the noughties when Facebook first and then Twitter came, of course this gave the potential of people being people citizens and citizen journalists and being able to write their own accounts directly on the internet of all sorts of things that they were doing and that they were experiencing. And this then started a new sort of fact-check industry where people were trying to modify the posts on social media so that they fitted with the same narrative that the mainstream media was using, which of course had the same narrative of governments and big corporations and things like that. But it's actually extended since then because it's spread much further. It's also spread to the mainstream media who were moderating the posts before in as much as they were taking their stories from governments and big corporations, but now they're all media is part of the fact check industry as well. It really has expanded worldwide. And when I spoke to you last time, I talked about my research covering the whole world. I think that I'm the only person who's an independent researcher into this. At least I haven't been able to find anybody else, although there are people who are doing fact checks in certain areas, particularly in the links between the American government and social media and how the American government are influencing social media. There's a group of American journalists and some European journalists and academics who are looking at that, but I don't think there's anybody that's looking at the whole world. But having done my my data sweep over the whole world, I've now started to sort of look very specifically at different areas and how they're fact-checking.
So we could, in a way, divide the world up, couldn't we? We could divide it into sort of TV zones now. This is where particular networks have got an influence and the people think like the networks want them to think there. You might look at maybe Russia, China, the West, as areas where, because of the TV regime in that part of the world, people have got a certain mindset. And in fact, many of the people who don't really pay attention, which I suppose is the majority, like, wasn't it, Aldous Huxley was saying something like 5% of the people can't be hypnotized and 5% of the people can be hypnotized really easily. Mm. And there's this great bulk in the middle that can be sort of pushed around, manipulated, and nudged. That seems to me to be a sort of, it's not just about television, it's also about the corporate structure in those parts of the world.
Indeed it is. And I think that also, I was going to talk to you in specific about what's happening in UK at the moment, in terms of censorship and fact checking. And I think that, a lot of the research has been done in America, and I'd like to sort of like point out a difference. America is the only country in the world where the government is forbidden by law, by constitution, in interfering with people's free speech and with journalists writing what they want to write. So there's no other country in the world where they have that specific
restriction. Well, it may be in the Constitution, but we've got things like Operation Mockingbird going on over decades, which was the CIA interfering in journalism, in having spies in newsrooms, getting people sacked, all this sort of thing.
Exactly, but it's covert rather than overt. Right. And in terms of social media, it's been exactly the same. So, for example, where the American government has definitely been influencing social media, we know that now because we've seen the emails and there's work of Schellenberger and Matt Taibbi. They're actually looking at these masses of emails that came from Elon Musk when he
This is the Twitter files.
Yeah, the Twitter files. And there's also a court case, Biden versus Missouri, and they're actually have got a lot more social media information about Facebook and other forms of social media.
I mean, it might
be,
I know it's a bit unfair to just spring this on you, but can you just tell us in a nutshell what the Twitter files revealed?
Well, the Twitter files, I mean, they still haven't finished analysing it yet. I mean, it was
a bit
just
like
a
WikiLeaks,
huge
isn't it? WikiLeaks did a massive dump of all the cables of Henry Kissinger, for example, like hundreds and thousands of these.
Yeah, exactly. It
so
was,
you have to go through
it. That because there was years and years worth of sort of emails between the American government and social media, and that suddenly was given to two journalists, Schellenberger and Taibbi, in America, and they have. I think they've employed other journalists to help them sort of analyse it. And what they've found, they've actually got the direct evidence that the government was actually writing emails to social media, and they were obviously on very friendly terms, and the government was paying money for certain groups and people to be taken off Twitter, and because they didn't like what they were saying. I mean,
before you carry on, I just want to spring this one on Martin as well, because Martin, one of the things the Twitter files did reveal, I mean, it's been absolutely fascinating, it's still a goldmine of information, but was the US government saying to the Twitter algorithm gurus, find us a load of stuff about the Russians fixing the elections, and then they wrote back to the US government saying, well, we can't. It's not happening, as far as we can see. There's nothing here that indicates that. But this isn't evidence for it not happening. It's just that they then try and choose another route to find evidence that Russia is hacking the American elections.
Well, I mean, as has been pointed out, there's been an enormous amount of influence of the US government on the whole of the internet and the social media sphere. It was even designed, you know, when the seed money was put into it by the Pentagon back in the, you know, whenever it was, they saw it as a mechanism for controlling people's minds. And of course, to a certain extent, they didn't quite foresee how uncontrollable it would be. Mm. But nevertheless, they saw it as a mechanism for interfering in society. They certainly did. I mean, look at the Arab Spring in 2011. They were being trained in how to use social media by government people, basically US government money. The National Endowment for Democracy goes all over the world dishing out money to young people, getting them into journalism and all the rest of it. That money used to be, in the 40s, channeled by the CIA to people under the table. So now do it openly. And of course, they're still doing stuff under the table, which they're not talking about.
Yeah.
And in other words, the idea that the government just sits on its hands and lets free speech
anyone
happen
that's paying attention last week to the interview we had on with the boss of Ofcom, she's already saying, oh, we think the Russians are trying to fix our British elections for next year. I mean, so this is obviously a thing which is going on, and it's just a lie. Mm. And the lady in charge of Ofcom is actually spreading more of the lie, the fake news.
It's quite interesting because in terms of fact-checking, because as I want to talk about UK in particular now, because UK doesn't have these any restrictions on the media, the government actually controlling speech. those don't exist in UK. So we have a lot more freedom, or government has a lot more freedom to control. And of course, governments always want to control, always have, you know, and it's only the people rebelling and striking and whatever that's actually, that actually changes that position. So that sort of tension is always there. But our government, I mean, for example, it's had its own fact-checking groups, but as well as fact-checking, there's this other thing which is now insidious, which is becoming a lot more funded and dominant, and which is the next phase of fact-checking, really, which is called media literacy, where they're talking about training people in critical thinking. Now, in theory, I'm all for people thinking critically, but I've done some of these media literacy courses, and what they do is they for example, they guide you to what they say is a trusted source is, things like, well, in medicine, for example, peer-reviewed papers, and then any paper that because the drug companies fund all of the major journals, anything that the pharmaceutical companies don't like doesn't get accepted in those journals. It's for people like the WHO, governments, even they sort of like they tell people to trust fact check groups. And this Ofcom, actually talking about Ofcom, I found out quite by secret, because I was delving into the way the EU funds media literacy, and then I came across these minutes of a meeting in which Ofcom was talking about how it's organising media literacy in UK. So I think Ofcom is actually in charge in UK of media literacy, and they're currently training 1,000 people who have a lot of contact with young people, and they're going to start their media literacy training in February 2024. And so this is sort of like the next phase, and it's rather than sort of like controlling what's in the news, they're controlling people. What you're talking about is that 5% that can be hypnotized, or and 5% who can't. But looking at the bulk in between, I mean, some people give different statistics, 10%, 10%, or 15%, 15%. But however it is, you know that there's a bulk in between, and the idea is to try to influence these people.
So, I mean, many of those people, I don't have no insight into this really, but I would have thought many of those people, the in-betweenies, have sort of given up with trying to follow the news. Because in a way, as I say at the start of the show, there's loads of gaslighting going on
there
the whole
time. There is indeed. And of course, if they sort of collar children, and a lot of the media literacy courses actually start in primary school, and of course they say that they're protecting children from online harms, I think that it is good to protect children from online harms, but included in this, they start straight away when children are really young, in getting them to sort of like think about collecting information into their heads in a sort of specific way. And then of course it gets more channeled in the courses as you get older. I've done some of the courses, so I can
actually, these are online, are they?
I did a course for adolescents. I did a course for journalists, and I did a course for
seniors. For these?
They're all free.
Oh,
Tony,
wonderful.
They are all free.
Wonderful.
All media literacy training is free. All fact check training is free. Anyway, to get back to the British government, it has its own fact-checking program, which was centred in the Department of Culture, Media and Sports, but it's recently moved to the Innovation Department. And this is called the Counter-Disinformation Unit. And it has, like all sort of like big government departments, it has a preferred flagger status, which means that instead of going through the ordinary channels on social media, it goes straight to, you know, the head office, as it were, on social media programs. And then it can say, well, we want to move this programme, or we want to move that programme. We want we don't like these tweets. We don't like this person. And there's evidence that the government has actually done that, because I think some people through Big Brother Watch actually put into a search into government departments to find out what the government had been doing about them particularly. So we have got some evidence there.
Also, well, let me just say something about specific news at the moment, and that is this BBC Verify have been looking at the, it's a sort of obvious question to ask them, really. Is it true that Hamas has some sort of special command centre under a hospital, so that's why you have to bomb the hospital and arrest the surgeons in the hospital? Well, to be fair to them, BBC, they can't quite bring themselves to say no, it's not true, but they are casting some doubt on it, saying, well, actually, the evidence that they're showing, the pictures that they're showing, there isn't really any evidence that they actually were taken at the hospital, this sort of thing. So there is a little bit of use to this, maybe.
And I think that, you know, like, when you look at research onto when the media covers both sides, it usually covers both sides because there are politicians on both sides who've got different views. I mean, for example, the Vietnam War, people say that it was the media that actually changed the direction of the war and caused the American government to fall out, to continue with the war. There was a lot of research about that, but then some researchers have said, no, that wasn't true. There was a lot of division within the American government about the Vietnam War. So I think that the very fact that the BBC are prevaricating actually shows that the politicians are now sort of divided on this issue. And so when the politicians are divided, the media doesn't take a definite side. And so I think that's probably in response to sort of like a lot of voting public, even in America now, are starting to sort of like think very differently about the war. Whereas if you get an issue where there's politicians are more in consensus, then the media doesn't tend to deviate. It gives only one story. And where the media doesn't deviate, the fact-check platforms do.
Martin, let's just bring in Martin here, because there's a much, much bigger side to all of this, and that is the entire agenda. Actually, most of the news agenda for the best part of the last week, really since last Sunday, all day, has been talking about this whole potential release of the hostages, not about the mass bombing that's been going on, which has killed another something like 3,000 or 4,000 people in the meantime. So the whole news agenda can be steered, can't it? So that the viewers, the listeners, the readers are being distracted away from the actual news.
That's true, but of course what you've got now with Al Jazeera, which is English language Qatari state TV, that's effectively what it is you do have a different view. So, for example, it's hardly ever mentioned that there are thousands of Palestinians detained by the Israelis. And when the Palestinians are holding prisoners, they're called hostages. When the Israelis are holding prisoners, they're called prisoners. Yeah, and this use of language, I mean, if you do an A-level in media studies, it is actually quite, does cover this sort of thing.
Well, it might,
and
it's actually regarded, might have done in your day.
No, I never did media studies. I'm just trying to say, I'll tell you something as an economist, business studies is regarded as a Mickey Mouse A-level by the top universities, because it is. It's economics with the hard bits taken
anyway,
out.
Anyway, there's been a
media
lot of,
studies is not.
There's been a lot of, we had Kevin Cahill, former Sunday Times journalist here a few weeks ago talking about this, bless him, and of course as usual Kevin's got a news story way before it ever hits the main news, and this has been in the news this week, this whole idea of Facebook feeding actually very disturbing videos to teenagers. In this case, the coroner actually ruled that, and whether he was right or wrong, I've no idea, but he ruled that Facebook had been was deliberately caused the death of this child. So let's have a listen to that report, who was on, I mean, Facebook killing children. That's effectively what the coroner's saying. Is anything going to happen about it?
Now, a recent groundbreaking court decision in America has allowed hundreds of families to sue four of the biggest tech companies in the world after claims the platforms caused harm to their children. Meta, TikTok, Snap and Google all say they'll plan to robustly defend themselves. But lawyers for the families point to the case of the 14-year-old British schoolgirl Molly Russell, who ended her own life after watching harmful content online, as an example of the dangers facing children on social media. Angus Crawford has that story.
I feel like they killed my son. That's how I feel.
Jennifer Mitchell had no idea. Her son, Ian, kept a secret.
I keep his ashes in here.
Ian didn't tell her about the graphic videos he saw on social media about Russian roulette. She only found out after he died, killed by a single gunshot. Jennifer, along with hundreds of other parents, is suing the social media companies she blames for Ian's death.
To me, it just feels like justice for my son. But at the same time, I feel like I can help other people.
Is that Jennifer?
Oh, yes.
Today,
yes.
She's sharing her story across the Atlantic with Ian, Molly Russell's father.
Kids are dying every day.
It's so grim, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Molly was just 14 when she ended her life. Her inquest revealed a stream of dark, depressing, graphic material which flooded her accounts.
We should not be sitting here. This should not happen because it does not need to happen.
The coroner decided Molly died while suffering the negative effects of online content. Those revelations in a small court in North London also made a huge impact across the Atlantic in the US capital.
Lawyers here in Washington watched the inquest via video link for any evidence that could help them as they sue some of the biggest tech companies in the world on behalf of hundreds of children and families in the US who claim the platforms caused them harm.
I think it was a really important watershed moment. You know, anytime you have someone stand up and actually fight back and win, it shows everyone else that it's possible.
The tech companies say the claims are unfounded and they'll robustly defend themselves. But across the US, more and more people are joining the action.
My daughter Molly.
In Colorado, feeling like a survivor, Taylor Little.
All of our stories are the same. Molly Russell's especially.
That was my second suicide attempt. And I was finally able to get real long-term treatment. I spent hours just reading about suicide on social media.
It took my life from me. I literally was trapped by addiction.
A landmark court case then, but also a very personal battle to hold social media to account. Angus Crawford, BBC News, Denver, Colorado.
Well, very creepy stuff. Judith, you know, I, for example, had a video taken down this week, which was of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. I got the message back saying, oh, this is from a banned channel. And I put that on social media. Well, and yet we've got videos circulating to teenagers.
Yeah.
Of things like suicide. So it does seem, actually very morbid stuff. I mean, it's like a kind of horror story that's being fed to these kids. There isn't any kind of policing of this going on. We've just got this online safety bill coming in. But my concern is maybe that is going to be used just as much to close down Sergei Lavrov as this suicide.
And, I mean, in UK alone, there's millions and millions going into the fact-check industry. I think that because the governments can openly fund, there's some huge organisations, fact-checking organisations in England that are really controlling the fact-check and media literacy agenda in UK, and they're very heavily funded.
Who pays for them?
Well, sometimes people are quite open and say, we take money from these governments. They just say, we take money from foundations and governments. So it very much varies. But, I mean, there's some, like, for example, the Open Information Partnership. Well, you can guess that's Orwell speak for something that controls information. And
sounds a bit like George Soros.
Yeah, yeah. And no, that's totally funded by the UK government.
Oh, is
that
it?
One. And
pinching his trademark.
And yeah, and then there's the Centre for Information Resilience. There's the the Institute of Strategic Dialogue. There's the Centre for Controlling Digital Hate. There's the Global Disinformation Index. They're all huge organisations. Some of them very shadowy. All of them very well funded. Some of them are funded to the tune of millions by the UK government. I think one very sinister organisation is now in the top 100 AI groups, but I'm sure you've never heard of it unless you've read my research. And that's a company called Logically. It's a fact check company. It also designs tools. It also does media literacy. It's a high tech company. It's a private fact checking group. It's based in UK, but it's linked to some universities in UK, Sheffield in particular. It's also linked to some universities in India, and it's got a fact-checking group in India, and I think it's also got one in America. It's absolutely vast, and there's also, which I think is specific to England, to UK, because I haven't been able to find a group anywhere else, but there's a group called Ostia, O-S-T-I-A, and this is a trades union organization for these tech companies that control information, and a lot of the companies that are it's meant to only register UK companies, but some companies that have got head office elsewhere, like NewsGuard, that control speech, are actually registered with Ostia.
NewsGuard.
I'm sure NewsGuard's been on to you, Tony, because what it does, it looks at different media companies and media organisations, and then it gives them a rating as to how reliable they are, and the nearer they are to the BBC and CNN, the more they're likely to be reliable. But if they're organisations that tell the truth, such as your radio programme, they're going to be told that it's very unreliable and dangerous, and don't listen to Tony, whatever you do.
Well, I always say people should always distrust me, you know, and fact check stuff themselves. Although what we're doing is hopefully is pointing them in the right direction. Look, Martin, we're talking about two slightly separate things here.
Yeah.
One is this whole idea of shoving all sorts of really poisonous content out on social media that teenagers can digest, and they may kill themselves would, you know, they're a very impressionable age. This is the sort of thing that absolutely should be banned, but it's not being banned.
No.
In the meantime, you've got lies being told, and social media companies now realise that they've got the vast majority of the audience now, and so something needs to be done to stop the truth getting out through there. So what do you make of these attempts through the online Signal Safety Bill to rein all this in, and also the fact checkers funded by government to tell us, oh, this is a lie, and to either get a screen put over the picture, a screen put over the article, or else to get the person who's posted it banned?
Well, obviously there are a lot of issues surrounding particularly young people using social media. I mean, for one obvious thing is it's absolutely straightforward for children to access hardcore pornography online, unless their parents prevent it. Obviously, there was always an interest in amongst young teenagers to look into this sort of thing, but of course it used to be much more difficult to get hold of than it is now. And that's just the relatively safe stuff, let alone when we're talking about, you know, suicide videos and so on. So there is an issue there, but I think what the politicians are doing is they're using people's genuine concern about this other stuff to try and police what is what should be regarded as political free speech. I mean, it is. I mean, I, there are various websites I use. Some of them, like I cannot guess RT, and I could probably fiddle it to get it if I needed to. But I mean, they've just openly said you can't watch this, And the reason why,
but you can't watch suicide films.
Yeah, yeah, you can watch. But the reason they the reason they banned it is because, in actual fact, it's quite reasonable and well put together, and it undermines their narrative. So the obvious thing to do is just get rid of it. Yeah. Because just basic factual stuff comes. Last time I was on RT, I was asked because a British Storm Shadow missile had been used to hit the naval headquarters in Sevastopol, and they claimed that they'd killed the top admiral in there, Admiral Sokolov. And of course, he then popped up in Moscow because he wasn't in the building, and in actual fact, the building was empty. But they just pushed this out there. We've killed the top admiral, isn't it brilliant, with a Storm Shadow
missile?
Well,
they say things like Lavrov and Putin are on death's door, don't they? That's another story.
All this sort of thing. But of course, the problem for them is if it's on the Freeview and people just flicking through it and they go RT, they will be saying, well, we've got this guy here and he's not dead.
Can I, all three of us just share some stuff that we've seen? Because over the last week or so, I watched a fascinating video. I mean, you can only really do this, you can only just sort of talk through it. There's not much point in putting a video up on a radio program. But they showed in the whole Gaza situation a scene which had actually been created for CNN, and the CNN crew is there filming it, where they're saying actually one Hamas fighter has managed to get through the wall again, and he's killing people and he's shooting at Israeli soldiers who are shooting back at him. And so this film crew filmed all this, and then in the background you can just see the guy who was supposed to be this Hamas guy who'd been arrested sitting down on a I don't know if you've seen this, you guys, sitting down on a tree stump, just sort of putting his clothes back on, and he was an actor. These sort of things are just set up now for the public. So I would say everything you see, particularly when it's saying that the Israelis are right and the Palestinians are wrong, particularly on those lines, or the World Economic Forum is right and the rest of the world is wrong, be extremely suspicious about what you're seeing, because there is, I mean, we had, I think, wasn't it, something like £2 or 3 billion had been spent on Bell Pottinger years ago, trying to fix, this is during the time of the Iraq and Syria wars, just fake videos that were just put out as news.
That's true, but what's also interesting is the guerrilla response of that to that, because the Israeli propaganda machine has been incredibly inept. If you get caught making lies up like that, that should everybody say, well, we're not going to believe anything you say. In a court of law, that means all your other evidence would be discounted. And during the Ukraine war, you've even got these, because they talk to each other, it is transparent. They say, we did a really good job telling lies about the ghost of Kiev, because the ghost of Kiev was supposedly this amazing lone pilot who was shooting down loads of Russian planes, and they were even boasting about how successful, it was a video game. And of course, somebody picked up on this is a video game. And of course, what's actually going on in real time is that people are creating these misinformational stories for warfare purposes, and other people are picking them apart.
So
it's a part of
Judith,
the war.
As the children often do when they're watching the news, if the news is on when mum and dad are around, they'll say, is this real or is it a play? Actually, we should be asking the same sort of question.
Yeah, exactly, we should be.
But anyway, so what do you make of some of the implications of what you're saying on this recent conflict in Gaza, which seems as if it's just a brief pause and then they're going to carry on? They've got this hideous idea that, you hand us over 10 hostages a day, we'll stop killing you for a day.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? I just don't. I just can't see the end to it, and I mean, I just personally feel that more and more people, and in particular in America, more and more Jews are actually starting to say, not in my name, but I can't see what the solution is. We created this situation 75 years ago, the world powers, by putting European Jews who were vulnerable into a country that didn't belong to them, where there were already people living there, and then when they claimed it as a state, people sort of accepting them saying that it was a state. So this was created 75 years ago, and what you've got is two sort of like very vulnerable people. And if you like, I think that Israel has to be the attack dog of the Middle East, causing disruption in the Middle East, because that's what world powers always like, disruption rather than sort of like peaceful.
Well, I mean, if you were a Satanist, right, or a really evil person, It's the place to turn into hell, isn't it? The Holy Land. This is the sort of thing that I suppose, you know, these rather nasty types might just sort of see as their kind of entertainment. But anyway, one of the great channels, I say it's quite great, is Al Mayadeen. I've been on it before. I know George Galloway is quite a regular on there. This is the state channel in Lebanon. It's all in Arabic. But Al Jazeera did a report on a couple of their journalists who were killed this week.
Mm.
They had just been on the border with Israel. Lebanon is just to the north, is in between Israel and Syria. In fact, actually, Syria borders on Israel too, if you know the map.
Yeah.
They're just north of Israel. And there's been all sorts of conflict on the border there with Hezbollah maybe threatening to come into Israel. But what they've basically been doing is they've been taking out all of the Israeli technology that's along the border, that is the cameras and things like that, and making sure that if they do want to sneak in, that the Israelis aren't watching them on TV as they do it. But anyway, these two people from Al Mayadeen have been doing journalism and explaining what's been going on that border. Well, this week the Israelis just decided to take them out. And there's a great cartoon which I'll put up on my show page at thisweek.org.uk with two bombs falling down. One is on a little kid in Gaza saying no mercy. And as there's a camera crew filming this little kid, there's another bomb falling down on them with an Israeli flag on saying no witness.
Mm.
But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Al Jazeera report on the deaths of these two Lebanese journalists this week killed by the Israeli, brave Israeli soldiers.
Okay, let's bring in Joseph El Kosefi. He is the head of the Lebanese Press Editors Syndicate. He joins me live on the phone now from Beirut. A very warm welcome to you. Firstly, your response to the latest deaths of three journalists who've been covering the conflict on the Lebanese border with Israel.
First of all, I would like to express my condolences to Al Mayadeen channel and the families of the journalists. This crime committed by Israel is not the first one and it's not going to be the last one. I believe they have declared war on journalists and media personnel from day one of Al-Aqsa flood operation. And if we are to count the number of our colleagues who have been killed in Gaza in occupied Palestine, the total number is now more than 60 journalists, without talking about their families who have been targeted deliberately by Israeli army and in Lebanon. This means that Israel deliberately targets journalists and media personnel in Palestine, in Lebanon, and everywhere where such people shed light on the crimes and genocide and massacres committed against civilians. No doubt that Israel has now feels that credit to the Arab journalism and media networks that covers all these crimes, because there is now a turn in the international public opinion. That's why Israel has escalated their aggression against journalists, making them targets by missile attacks from aeroplanes. This is a crime. This is a crime that amounts to that can amount to a war crime.
So that's a bit of live translation there from Arabic into English on Al Jazeera from the Al Mayadeen people and the journalist committee in over in Lebanon. This week, the Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ, said at least 53 journalists and media workers have been killed since October the 7th. The deaths include 46 Palestinians, 4 Israelis and 3 Lebanese citizens. Additionally, 3 journalists have been reported missing, 11 injured and 18 have been arrested. Of course, that's by the Israeli side. Journalists across the region are making great sacrifices to cover this heartbreaking conflict. Said the CPJ Middle East and North Africa program coordinator Sherif Mansour. Those in Gaza in particular have paid and continue to pay an unprecedented toll and face exponential threats. So this is one of the things the Israelis have said they're extremely worried about with having a humanitarian pause, that's what they call it, is that journalists might get in there. They may actually do stories which are not positive to the Israelis. But one of the main points to make here about this sort of, I suppose, you know, the journalistic angle on this is, of course, the reason they're killing journalists is so that the media organisations are thinking, well, we better not send any journalists in there, they might get killed.
Yeah, exactly.
It sends a very strong message to the managers.
Exactly.
And the human resources people who are responsible for the safety of their employees.
Yeah. And I must say, I think that on this particular war in Gaza, Al Jazeera has been magnificent. I can't fault them. And I've even seen the anchors in the studio crying when they've been listening to the reports that have been coming from Gaza. So I just would like to congratulate Al Jazeera and to suggest to people, if they want a fuller picture of the war than the picture that's given on the BBC, for example, and Sky, to have a look at Al Jazeera.
Well, isn't it interesting, because Press TV and RT have also been doing some excellent coverage. We're not allowed to see that. No. We're only allowed to see Al Jazeera, aren't we?
Well, at the moment.
At the moment,
of course,
yeah.
At some point they may decide that they don't want to see that as well.
Yeah.
I think another thing that they've not been, this is why they were taking the internet down in Gaza, because people are able to create citizen journalism as well.
Yeah.
And of course, it looks as if the people all over the Middle East, for example, are watching their Facebook feeds and they're getting direct information from Gaza. And this is very difficult for the power brokers to control, other than by closing down the internet completely or switching off the electricity. I mean, the actual situation obviously could go in all sorts of different ways from here, but the control of media, I mean, after the Vietnam War, the US military decided that was what lost us the war, is what you said earlier.
Yeah.
Probably wasn't, but that's what they thought. And then, of course, by the time you get to the Falklands War, the journalists are embedded with the British forces.
Yeah,
they're only allowed to go if they, and everything
and
they do
Iraq
has
war
to be
as well.
Yeah,
yeah,
has to be. Yeah, because when John Pilger used to go out to Vietnam, he used to wander around on his own interviewing people. They make really sure that that doesn't happen now. And the way you do it is, if anybody's off the park, you make sure they're killed.
Mm.
And that means that's a clear message to the independent journalists who might go off their own bat or from a small organisation. You'll end up dead. If you come in with the Israeli army, you'll be all right. We won't kill you.
And actually that happened in the Iraq war. That a lot of journalists who were independent were killed. I mean, a lot of British journalists. I mean, there was one from HTV. And also a missile went directly into Al Jazeera headquarters in Baghdad, I think.
That's mention Terry Lloyd in March 2003?
Yes.
That what the military said when they invaded Iraq in that illegal war was, you can have some of your journalists embedded with us if you want, so they could be in a tank. So the media organisations at that time, ITN, said yes, but we do want to have independent journalists. Well, virtually as soon as he arrived, Terry Lloyd was killed,
He was taken out
The investigation said it was American troops. He was in a vehicle, and there were some Iraqis turned up to surrender on his left hand side of his vehicle. And they and he were all killed by American soldiers on the right-hand side of the vehicle. So this is a way of saying, look, any journalist that's not sitting in one of our tanks under our direct supervision, we're going to blow your head off.
Well, another thing that happened in Gaza, I understand, is that one of the journalists who works for Al Jazeera, they've got the place is under complete surveillance. They killed his wife and children.
Yeah? They did.
So they're not just killing you, because journalists are going to do that sort of job. They're brave. They're prepared to die to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
Are they prepared to have their kids die? And, of course, the Israelis are sending a very clear mafia-like message by that what they did there.
Anyway, this week, Norman Finkelstein, who's a long-time commentator, and the first book of his I ever read was called The Holocaust Industry, which is a fascinating book, all about how accounts of the Holocaust, some of them had been deliberately fabricated, and he shows clear evidence that, that this was a deliberate attempt in his book, The Holocaust Industry. But anyway, Norman is a staunch defender of human rights for the Gazan people, and he was on Piers Morgan's program this week.
Anything I write, I have my parents looking at the screen behind me over my shoulders. In a metaphorical sense, I am very conscious. Every moment of my existence, every moment of my existence goes back to the martyrdom of my family. So it's not as if suddenly you're posing a question to me that never occurred to me. Quite the contrary, I do need, even 30 years after their death, I need the moral validation that came from my parents' martyrdom and the extermination of their family. How would my parents have reacted? My guess is if on the first day they heard that inmates in a concentration camp burst its gates, I think my parents would be very pleased at that fact. As the events became clearer, my guess, but this is pure speculation, my guess is my parents would go out with their hearts, would go out to those who burst the gates of the concentration camp and whose lives were destroyed. Now, you will say to me, completely legitimately, you would say, well, what would your parents feel about the innocents who were slaughtered in the atrocities on that date? So I'm going to give you as close an answer as I could give, as I'm able to. I once asked my late mother, I said to her, what was your feeling when you heard that the German cities were being terror bombed during World War II? The carpet bombing of the German cities targeting civilians. What was your feeling? And my mother's response to me was, quote, our feeling was, if we're going to die, we're going to take some of them with us. Now, that's not the most morally elevated statement. I agree. And do I wish my mother had and my father had a heightened sensitivity to German civilian life? I suppose I would wish it. But I will tell you, Piers, to the last day of my parents' life, it was unthinkable that they would have a kind word to say about Germans. And it was unthinkable that I would ever quarrel with them on that point.
Okay.
I accepted that given their life experience, they had the right to hate the people who destroyed their lives.
Okay.
And the people of Gaza have the right to hate the people who destroyed their lives.
So that's the Jewish Israeli writer Norman Finkelstein. I'm not sure if they've come to arrest him yet.
But did you hear the bit afterwards? Because obviously he's a really powerful speaker, and Piers couldn't challenge him on the program. But afterwards, he got this man who is sort of like some sort of Zionist to absolutely character assassinate him and say he uses his parents for his excuse for hating people, and you know, and he uses the Holocaust to show his hateful rhetoric. And so,
self-hating Jew. Yeah.
So whereas Piers Morgan couldn't criticise him actually in the programme, and actually at the end of the programme, Finkelstein thanked him for being polite, and then after he thanked him, he brought in this bloke who did this character assassination on him.
This is Rupert Murdoch's channel, I imagine, isn't it? It's Talk TV.
Yeah.
And of course, Rupert Murdoch does have, along with Jacob Rothschild, quite a big oil concession in the Golan Heights.
Yeah.
So this is the way it works, Martin, isn't it? Well, what do you make of Norman Finkelstein's arguments there?
Well, it's irrefutable what he's saying. It's no use saying that if you misuse other people, they've got to forgive you. They're not going to. Why would they? I mentioned the other week when we had our Israeli colleague on here about Uri Avonry. And I looked him up afterwards because I remembered about who he was. And he was actually born in Germany. Mm. He was the son of a banker. And in 1933, when Hitler came to power, his family fled to Israel. So that's how he ended up there. And he was part of the Irgun, which was a terrorist organisation which killed British police officers, soldiers and Palestinian civilians. Nobody was ever punished for any of that. I think a couple of them were hung during the occupation. But after that, they got a state. And the people who led the Irgun, Shamir and Begin, became prime ministers of that state. And they weren't punished in any way. The head of Hamas at the moment is Hanifia. He's been talking to everybody. He's been to Russia. He's been talking to... Hamas are an organisation modelled on the Irgun. That's exactly what they're modelled on. They use exactly the same tactics and strategy. They've looked at how the Israelis got their state, and they're saying that's how we're going to get our state. Uri Avonry was involved in all of that, and then he repudiated it. So he's a bit different from Finkelstein. He was a right-winger, but his peace witness in the end was very powerful. Because when the right wing said, well, you can't just agree with the Israeli civilians being killed, he said, why not? We killed loads of their civilians.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to do.
And actually he started the peace movement, Gush Shalom, as well, which is
he died a couple
active.
Of years ago.
Yeah,
but he was a fantastic voice for peace. In a minority of one sometimes in Israel, but he was very courageous.
Norman Finkelstein, instead of having somebody on to have a go at him now, we're going to give him a second bite to the cherry. And here's a clip of Norman basically defending his right to criticise the Israeli government, where he's being accused, actually, of being a self-hating Jew by somebody in the audience.
I don't like to play before an audience the Holocaust card. But since now I feel compelled to, my late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother, please shut up. My late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on my father's side,
the Jews did not take arms against the Jews.
My late father was in Auschwitz concentration camp. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on both sides was exterminated. Both of my parents were in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it's precisely and exactly because of the lessons my parents taught me and my two siblings, that I will not be silent when Israel commits its crimes against the Palestinians. And I consider nothing more despicable than to use their suffering and their martyrdom to try to justify the torture, the brutalization, the demolition of homes that Israel daily commits against the Palestinians. So I refuse any longer to be intimidated or browbeaten by the tears. If you had any heart in you, you would be crying for the Palestinians, not for what you've done.
Okay, so that's Norman Finkelstein. I think, you know, it's useful to get into this whole idea of anti-Semitism, the way it's been weaponized, Martin.
It's obviously crucial to what's going on, the misuse of the term anti-Semitism, isn't it? I mean, years ago, just a little anecdote, I was speaking against the first Gulf War down at Speaker's Corner, and there was quite a big Zionist, I had an audience, there was quite a few people Zionists in the audience, and I said, this morning, Marek Edelman called for the immediate withdrawal of all Israeli occupation forces from all occupied parts of Palestine. And they shouted up from the back, because obviously it's an informal meeting, said, who's he, some self-hating Jew? I said, no, he was the commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He lives in Warsaw. And he said he was always opposed to Zionism. He led the Jewish fighting organization in the Warsaw Uprising. And after the war, he completely criticized the state of Israel. He said his attitude was, I'm Jewish, I'm Polish, I'm from Warsaw, and I'm not going anywhere.
Well, back in 2002, former Israeli Education Minister Shulamit Aloni popped up on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money. And the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay, they are talented people and they have power, money and media and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
I mean, every time I hear someone talk about anti-Semitism, that voice is in the background, in the back of my head, Shulamit Aloni, saying it's a trick. We always use it, Martin.
Well, isn't it interesting that such the arrogance and self-confidence where you actually come out and say that? And, of course, in this day and age, we can keep repeating that. That could become a meme on social media from the show.
What she's
they just don't see. You know, they're so arrogant. I mean, a lot of Caitlin Johnson.
Who is they?
The people in charge. Yes.
On this side too.
Katie Johnson's latest stuff is all about how bad the Hasbara has been for the Israelis around Gaza. Because they're blatantly making stuff up and then having to come back. I mean, they're just arrogant in every way that they're approaching all of this stuff. And that may be their undoing in the end.
But it's not only about situations relating to Israel, is it? Or I mean, for example, if they want to take out any politician, they start sort of an anti-Semitic notion going. And once it spreads to the media, I mean, look at Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, I don't think there's any politician that we've ever had in Parliament that's been less anti-Semitic than Corbyn. And yet, I mean, some people like him, some people don't. I did. But then because he had this sort of like grassroots popularity, they tried to find a way of taking him out, and they used anti-Semitic.
That was about Gaza, wasn't it? In a way, because you know what's happened is this is like the home front in the UK. Any politician that supports supports the Palestinians has been basically shot, you know, in a metaphorical fashion. But really, Martin, what Shulamit Aloni is describing there is a very powerful Israeli mafia, isn't it? I mean, she's saying we have lots of very powerful business people, and she even talks about their very strong influence through the press, which is our eyes and ears. Really, it's the nervous system of humanity, the press. It's the way we find out what's going on in other parts of the world, and there's an Israeli mafia dominating it.
Well, I mean, when we use the word Israeli...
That's not me. Said that.
Yes, I know, but when you say Israeli mafia, don't forget a lot of the top mafia were pro-Zionist Jews. Meyer Lansky, who headed the mafia in the United States, was part of the pro-Zionist network. And, of course, they cooperated with Mossad. There's lots of overlap here, yeah? And, of course, the methods are the same. Blackmail, yeah? all of this stuff, it's not just, the state itself is a terroristic state. If we're going to say that Hamas is a terrorist organisation, even though they're the elected government of Palestine, because they are, then I could say, well, the Israeli state's a terroristic state, even though they're the elected government of Israel. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, surely. I mean, when Gaddafi didn't use air power to knock down so-called peaceful demonstrators who were fighting his armed forces with AK-47s, we put in a no-fly zone. Where's the response? Why can't we put in a no-fly zone over Gaza? We could just do it. The US fleet's there. You can't use aircraft against these people. You're going to have to go in and fight them on the ground. This is what they said to Gaddafi's security forces. We're going to give them air cover. But, of course, they didn't just give them air cover. The SAS and all the rest of them went in there to help the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group to defeat Gaddafi, even though they eventually blew up Manchester Arena. As we all know, the first victim of any war is the truth. And modern warfare is also very much fought on social media and in forums like this sitting around this table. Mm. This is how these wars are fought and won. And, of course, there's two sides to this. One is the overwhelming power of big forces like Sheldon Adelson, who is the biggest contributor to US politics, very pro-Israeli. And, of course, he was a casino magnate from Las Vegas. Anybody can make the connections here. And he also said that we should turn Iran into a glass, just turn it into a car park. Now this is what we're up against. But on the other hand, modern technology does give us the capacity to fight back by unpicking the lies. As soon as the lie comes out, you can unpick it straight away. If they've used, I mean, they used an actress pretending to be a nurse in Gaza hospital, saying that she was really upset with Hamas because they brought all this trouble on them, blah, blah, blah. And it just was exposed within 2 hours that she was an Israeli actress, paid for by the government. Now, at that point, you just say, I'm not taking anything that the Israelis say at face value. Even when they're telling the truth, I'm not going to believe them. And at that point, they've lost the war. Because they have. Well, at some point, they're going to lose their status.
No, you've seen that, but not a lot of people have, Martin. It's not on the main news, is it?
No, not on the main news in Britain. But in the Middle East, everybody's following this glued to their phones. They're following all of it. And they're not getting it mediated necessarily through mainstream media. And the Israelis have... we could go on to what may happen next in this war. Because, of course, it is potentially... The big one for all of us.
Of course, a lot of the Israeli media is actually covering it in a completely different way. And there's a lot more diverse opinions, and particularly about the initial raid by Hamas.
I'm
sure they did do some dreadful things. That doesn't surprise me at all. But a lot of the stories, like for example, the rapes and the beheadings, that are probably not true. I think that Norman Finkelstein said that they were probably not true. But also, there's so much evidence from Israelis themselves that it was actually the IDF that killed a lot of the hostages rather than Hamas.
A lot of this is all to do with manipulating the news agenda, which is what the intelligence services love to do.
Yeah.
And so what we need, of course, is a really good whistleblower from the Mossad or from the Israeli intelligence services to tell us all about it. So who better than author of a terrific book? I would recommend anyone that that's a little bit sceptical about the power of the intelligence services, but enjoys a good spy novel. It's not really a novel. It's a book about his time. Viktor Ostrovsky in the Mossad is this book by way of deception. And here's what he's got to say about how this all operates.
I had a record with my second book. I think my first book sold something around the world, close to 8 million copies. My second book was not reviewed in any newspaper in North America. Now that's a record. No, I'm sorry. I think the guy in the Phoenix Gazette and the people from B'nai B'rith walked in and asked for him to resign. Yeah, because he's an anti-Semite. Now, I know what they do because I used to ask them to do it. I mean, when I was in the Mossad and we had a guy that gave us problems in the U.S. and he was speaking out and he was talking like Pete talked once and said, Israel is bombing Lebanon with cluster bombs. We say, hey, Who's that guy? You know, Pete McCarthy, we used to call him. Yeah, which is Pete the Cockroach. Because he makes a lot of noise and you can't get rid of him. So what you do is you get in touch with a guy in the station in New York or in the station in Washington. You say, tell the guys at B'nai B'rith to label him. And of course the campaign starts, and before you know it, the guy's labeled. And he's an anti-Semite. Because that's what we say he is. And that's one stain you cannot wash. Now, it shames me as a Jew to tell you that. But that's the fact. And it's wrong.
Good old Viktor Ostrovsky, terrific book. I always remember one line from The Way, by the Way of Deception, where it's this guy saying, but I thought he was my friend. I mean, this is the way that they'd got, somebody had kind of managed to drill themselves into the target's life and become very, very good mates with them, take them. Well, the idea was, of course, they were trying to get him into some sort of criminal operation. But they were very, very good, Martin, at pretending to be, oh, look, you know, we've got so many common interests, and getting themselves really, it's a bit like hacking somebody's life, a bit like the police were doing here with the environmental protesters, actually getting them so far into an organisation that they then control and run it.
Well, there was a recent book, was there not, about Rise Up and Kill First, which was written by another ex-Israeli intelligence
agent. Someone or other.
Yeah, and basically, he got a lot of information. He'd written it, but he got lots of information from inside the Israeli intelligence services. And the thing is about these people, like all big criminals, they cannot help boasting about their crimes. That's how the cops catch loads of people, because they just can't help it. When they've got away with something, and it's all worked out really well, and they've all had a round of bubbly because they've managed to fool everybody.
It's Ronan Bergman, but he's been very, very limp on this whole Gaza business.
No, well, of course, but because the point is, he's very much part of the establishment, and the book was written for them. You know, it was all about how good we are at getting our retaliation in first, and aren't we marvellous?
But no, they're assassinating people who they predict might be a threat in the future.
Yes, and they're even boasting about it. The point of the book is it's not trying to say, isn't this terrible? It's boasting about it. Some of the people talking to them were boasting.
Hang on, because we're getting down a bit of an interesting rabbit hole here, aren't we? Yeah. Because, what's his name? Alan Frankovich, he went round interviewing all these people for...
Yeah, the head of SISMI.
I think, wasn't it Kwan Company Business, the film about all the Central Intelligence Agency stuff. He shot that, I think it was in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And the thing is that these people were so egotistical. They loved the idea of being on TV, but what they didn't quite realise is he was stitching together a brilliant documentary, was exposed.
Look at what Louis Theroux did with Eugène Terblanche in South Africa. He befriended him, and he became a part of his life, and then he made this devastating film about what a crazy guy he was. Because people are actually, even the most evil people, are actually quite naive, you know, and therefore these are all tactics that we're talking about.
Well, I mean, there's also the Al Jazeera film that exposed people who were in the Jewish lobby that were influencing the Labour Party, and that was in three parts. Yeah,
so it's all out there in the public domain. Yeah. It's just that people aren't really doing anything about it because there's this enormous mafia out there that will either come down on you, or else it might actually give you a few crumbs from its table. Anyway, look, one of the best Israeli journalist on this is a guy called Gideon Levy. So let's have a listen to him now talking about what he says are the three Israeli indoctrination principles which are drilled into all Israelis literally from birth.
I'll just give the three principles which enable us Israelis to live so easily with this brutal reality. Most of the Israelis, if not all of them, deeply believe that we are the chosen people. And if we are the chosen people, we have the right to do whatever we want. B, there were more brutal occupations in history. There were even longer occupations in history, even though the Israeli occupation gets to quite a nice record. But there was never in history an occupation in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim around. This also enables any Israeli to live in peace because we are the victims. The other day, Professor Falk spoke about this dual strategy of Israel of being a victim on one hand and manipulating the other on the other hand, after what happened in Paris and in Copenhagen with the terror attacks, Benjamin Netanyahu came with the notion all the Jews must come to Israel. It's the safest place for the Jews in the world. It's a shelter for the Jews in the world. Which is wrong, because Israel is today the most dangerous place on earth for Jews. But let's put it aside. It was only 24 hours later when he said Israel is an existential threat under the Iranian bomb. And I asked myself, how can you dare call Jews to come and to join this suicidal project when the Iranians are going to bomb us? But in Israel, everything goes, and both declarations were accepted as the only truth. And here I get to the third set of values which enable us Israelis to live in peace with the occupation. And this is maybe the most crucial one and the worst one. We say victimization, we say chosen people. When I say victimization, it goes without saying we have to mention the Holocaust and the unforgettable Mrs. Golda Meir that the American Jewry had exported to Israel. She said once, this unforgettable woman, that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. But the third set of values is the most dangerous one, and this is the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, which enable us Israelis to live in peace with everything, because if they are not human beings like us, then there is not really a question of human rights. And if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost no one will treat the Palestinians as equal human beings like us. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations. Rightly so. But by the end of the day, how many Israelis did ever try for a moment to put themselves in the place of the Palestinians for a moment, for one day? And I want to give you two examples which will demonstrate it. Many years ago, I interviewed then candidate for Prime Minister, Ehud Barak. And I asked him a question which I try to ask in any occasion. Mr. Barak, what would have happened if you would have been born Palestinian? And Barak gave me then the only honest answer he could give me. He said I would have joined a terror organization. What else would have he done? Would he become a poet? He doesn't know to write poems. Would he become a pianist? He's quite a bad pianist. And I doubt if he would have become a collaborator, because he is a fighter. And it became a scandal, because how can you dare to put Ehud Barak to think what would have happened if he would have become a Palestinian? And the second incident, briefly, Second Intifada, the city of Jenin, the most closed city in the West Bank, real total siege. I go out from Jenin, I come to the checkpoint, a Palestinian ambulance is parking there with the red lights. I stand after him, no cars can get out of Jenin in those days, no cars can get in, and I wait. The soldiers are playing Begamon in the tent. Usually I know myself, it's better that I don't get into confrontation with the soldiers, because it always ends up very badly. So I stayed in the car, but after 40 minutes I couldn't take it, and I went out to the car. From the car, I went first to the Palestinian ambulance driver and asked him, what's going on? He told me that's the routine. They let me wait 1 hour until they come and check the ambulance. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I went to the soldiers. It became a confrontation. But the question that I asked them, which really brought them to direct their weapons toward me, was one. What would have happened if your father would have been lying in this ambulance? This freaked them out. They lost control. How can I dare to compare between their father and the Palestinian in the ambulance? And this set of beliefs that they are not human beings like us, enable us Israelis to live in so much peace with those crimes, ongoing crime for so many years, with losing any kind of humanity, values. I heard today people talk about Jewish values. I must be frank with you. I don't know what are Jewish values. I know what are universal values. Let's not get into it, really. There are very clear universal values. And there is a very, very clear international law. But for most of the Israelis, international law is very important. But not for Israel. Israel is a special case.
So that's Gideon Levy there with, I think, a pretty good summary of the Israeli mindset. And, of course, Martin, it's a mass indoctrination has been going on here. The idea is that he's saying, it's actually a beautiful way to finish there. He's saying, well, yes, international human rights at the United Nations is very important, but not for us. We're a special case.
Yeah.
That's what they say. That's what they claim. And, of course, the conflict in between Israel and Palestine isn't the only conflict going on in the world. They quite rightly say, well, why isn't everybody concerned about all these other things? We've not been talking much about Yemen, but that's been tragic on.
No,
Yemen, or Syria.
Yemen war has finished some time ago, but, well, you know, in terms of
the consequences.
Let's just hear a little bit about Yemen, because it is one of your top subjects, Judith.
I think that it's quite interesting, because when they started bombing Ukraine, there wasn't a peace, any peace process going on at the time, but almost exactly a month later, Saudi Arabia unilaterally said that it was going to stop bombing Yemen, which I think was quite interesting, because what it demonstrated was that the West can't provide weapons to bomb in two arenas at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what's happening in Ukraine now, because that war seems to have completely gone off the boil, but in terms of the media. But I suspect that if whatever weapons they were providing for Ukraine have now been directed to Gaza. So I just feel that that the West, with its sort of very sophisticated weapons, can't produce them quickly enough. But certainly, you see, I mean, there was a peace accord, which was, first of all, Saudi Arabia tried to dominate it, but then the Yemenis refused. There's, I think, 8 or 9 different warlords that are involved in the peace groups, plus Saudi Arabia. Oman was the mediator, and they were getting on really well. In fact, Saudi Arabia in particular had made concessions that they didn't expect them to make. Like, for example, it said that it would pay all the civil servants in Yemen who hadn't been paid since 2017, 2 years after the start of the war. And then America thought that the peace accords were going too well, so it sent along an envoy to help. And ever since then, the peace talks seem to have come to a halt. Which just makes you think that America didn't want peace, and doesn't want peace in Yemen. So Yemen is still in a state of limbo, but it's not in a state of war. And
haven't,
of course,
they been lobbing a few drones?
Yeah,
Israel,
they shot down a US drone, and they've captured an Israeli vessel.
Yeah,
and the US is talking about putting the Anasrullah onto the international terrorism list.
Yeah,
I mean, the problem with what's happening in Gaza, it's just the fulcrum of all these other things running out into Kurdistan, Ukraine, Azerbaijan.
One of the main problems in Gaza has been the whole idea of putting the Hezbollah, putting Hamas and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard on this terrorist list. Well, actually, have they been put onto this terrorist list? They are states that we don't like. I mean, obviously, the Palestinians haven't quite got a state, so in a way, they're more justified in having an armed wing.
Yeah.
But the idea that there are whole millions of people out there who, when their government decides it wants to fight back, then they're going to call them terrorists and actually ban the organisation. I mean, it's a little bit like you're treating Hamas like it's, say, the IRA or something.
The IRA, like Hamas, will ultimately have to be negotiated, and guess what? They are being negotiated with. this peace agreement for 4 days or whatever could have been agreed at the beginning. Scott Ritter was saying that the Israelis should have just stopped at the border and said, "Right, we want our hostages back."
So, is the idea that they negotiated now 40,000 people? Or sorry, how was it? 15,000 people. Some say 40,000 because there's a lot of people unaccounted for, buried under wreckage, and also, of course, the communications have been shut down. So it's been very difficult to assess the number of people. Now, so the Israelis have basically said, "Well, okay, so we've got another 40,000. Rid of another 40,000. We've mown the lawn. Now it's time to start talking."
I think what's happened is because they haven't got a clear military goal. And they don't really know, apart from killing the Palestinians.
This idea of destroying Hamas seems to me absolutely fallacious. Hamas is an idea. It's a resistance movement, which is going to be get growing bigger.
Even on a practical level, they haven't destroyed them.
If one movement isn't operating as a resistance movement, as the Fatah, when it became the PA, started, it just totally became a Israeli government instrument, really. And so therefore Hamas started, and of course the people who were all fed up with the PA because it was doing exactly what Israel wanted when there was election then voted for Hamas because what they wanted was resistance. So if they wiped out Hamas, of course there would be another resistance movement. And in fact what Vanessa Bailey says, and she knows quite a lot about the Middle East, was that this attack on Israel on the 7th of October was actually 10 Palestinian resistance groups, not just Hamas. And it's the first time that they've been able to sort of like agree to and coordinate with each other in order to do something really effective. I think she's got a lot of sources, and I suspect that that's probably the right case. So it's not just Hamas, is it? But I think that what I think they did want to do was to push the people of Gaza into Sinai, and that's the reason why they stopped water and food going into Gaza. It was a plan at ethnic cleansing, but I think that the reason why they've had to falter on that is simply because of the world reaction and the Arab reaction. And of course Israel, no matter how much money you give them, don't want to have Palestinians in Sinai, because the people pro-Palestinian, the rulers, because they've got their mouths are stuffed with gold, are keeping relationships with Gaza going. So there's such a difference between the people and the government that if Palestinians from Gaza were ethnically cleansed into the Sinai, then I think that would be a situation that the Egyptian government wouldn't be able to control.
They've refused it.
They know that it would politically be politically.
Martin, do you want to say something about how premeditated all this is? Because when we've seen this massive campaign to destroy the pro-Palestinian parts of the Labour Party, which, in its original forms, was always pro-Palestinian. I mean, so it's amazing that the way they've managed to turn that party round by getting people like Starmer, bigging him up, getting him elected as the leader. But even the tiny little parties over here apparently have been being approached over the last few years to see if they will take some money to support the Israelis. And this is a guy called David Curtin. He's not Curtin as in, on the windows, K-U-R-T-E-N. And he's in the London Assembly with something called the Heritage Party.
I could have been a lot richer. The Heritage Party could have had a lot more money than we have at the moment. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of more pounds we could have had. Because there was one time where I did a show in a television studio. I'm not going to say which channel it was and where it is. It was about a year ago. And we were just talking about the things that, I espouse and the Heritage Party espouses in our manifesto: traditional family values, free speech, controlling our borders, all of, socially conservative positions. And there was another gentleman there in the studio, very nice, got on with him very well, but he was Jewish. And that doesn't mean anything at all. You know, people from all faiths and no faiths, we can agree on lots of fundamental principles. But, you know, we got on very well. He liked what we stood for. I told him about the Heritage Party. And then he says, oh, well, I have to get you some money then. I thought, well, this is great. So I kept in touch with the guy. But very, very soon afterwards, it became clear that money would become available if I took on a position regarding the Middle East, because he would send me emails and articles that he'd written, which was all about how there was no such thing as a Palestinian people. The Israeli state had a right to the whole land. It was the ancient Jewish homeland. The Palestinians should actually really move to Jordan or Egypt. And, you know, the Jewish people who live in Israel should take full control of what's happening there. Now, I mean, he's totally entitled to his opinion. I try not to comment on the Middle East because Israel-Palestine is a minefield. People have very, very strong opinions in either direction. I'm concerned about the UK and what's happening in our country and getting our country right, well, without worrying about, you know, other people in the Middle East who've been fighting over this land for many, many decades. But it was very clear that money would come my way if I supported one side in the Israel-Palestine ongoing conflict, and that would be to support the state of Israel against the Palestinian people. So I turned it down.
So that's David Curtin, K-U-R-T-E-N. He's on the London Assembly. This, Martin, I think is, you know, this is where it really starts to hit, isn't it? Where you realise that actually your politics is controlled. We know the Labour Party is controlled through this fake anti-Semitism. And we know that the Conservative Party, the various people there have been pushed out of the way, including Alan Duncan, after the Al Jazeera program, the lobby that Judith was talking about. So even the tiny parties, they're making sure that they've got it absolutely locked down, British politics.
Well, British politics, and of course even more so in US politics, where Joe Biden, Donald Trump, RFK Jr. are all absolutely 100% behind the Israelis' position on Gaza.
What about here in Bristol? Even our MPs didn't dare vote for a ceasefire.
I think what's going to be very interesting about that, if we can come bring it down to our little level, is Thangam Debonair, they've just changed the boundary. So Easton and Lawrence Hill are now going to be in Bristol East. So the boundary becomes smaller. So Bristol West now becomes a smaller constituency.
So the Greens are going to take her place?
Yes, but this is it. You see, Thangam Debonair wants to have a seat in Keir Starmer's cabinet. And she's very close to Keir Starmer. And she's got a good chance of getting a seat in the cabinet. But first of all, she's got to win the election. And by not voting for a ceasefire, she may lose the election.
Yeah, we had a thing in Bristol West. Valerie Davy,
who used to hold the seat,
She lost it to the Lib Dems,
because not because she voted for the Iraq war, but because she abstained. Bristol West is the most radical constituency in the country on these issues. Yes, listen, this is Bristol calling out there for people in the rest of the world.
Watch it, Thangam.
But the thing is that radical vote isn't necessarily going to go to the Labour Party. Mm. It went to the Liberal Democrats for two terms, and that vote is very soft. And the Greens are going to win the council election in Bristol next May. It's pretty clear. And that will put them up in a very strong position
to go off and be a violin teacher then, maybe. But before Judith goes, we've got to hear a bit of Lord Cameron meeting Benjamin Netanyahu this week.
I wanted to come in person and go to the south of the country and go to Kibbutz Be'eri to see just the true nature of the horrific attacks that you faced. I think it's very important to do that and see that. And, you know, we stand with the people of Israel in sympathy for what you have gone through. I think that was important. But today, obviously, it's important we talk about this potential humanitarian pause. I think it's an opportunity to crucially get hostages out and to get aid into Gaza. There's never an excuse for this sort of hostage taking. All the hostages should be released. But I hope everyone who's responsible behind this agreement can make it happen to bring relief to those families, including, of course, there are British nationals who've been taken hostage. And so that, let's hope that that can be delivered. But thank you for the time. There's lots of things to talk about. It's very good to see you again.
Well, here it is. It's like deja vu all over again, isn't it? Here's David Cameron.
Good to see you. Good to see you, BB.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they went to the kibbutz. The kibbutz was bombed to pieces by the Israeli Defense Forces. That's what the destruction is.
That was written about by Jonathan Cook, who said they were so badly destroyed that it couldn't have
Hamas have got small arms. Yeah, they can't blow everything up. Yeah. They didn't have time to burn anybody. Yeah. And the burned bodies are the remains of what these... Because they followed a clear policy of what they call the Hannibal Directive, because they know that Hamas is trying to take hostages, either military or civilian... And of course, the military hostages aren't even hostages. They're prisoners of war. That's what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and a civilian...
And what about the Palestinians that have been kept hostages?
Well, exactly. They're prisoners, you see, Tara. They're prisoners, not hostages.
But what about the 2.3 million Gazans who have been kept hostage?
Well, indeed.
So let's release all the hostages, the Palestinian prisoners, the people of Gaza, hostages. I think that would be a really good end.
Well, obvious thing for the Israelis to have done is they could have surrounded Gaza and said, right, civilian population, you can come through our lines into Israel, where we can put you on the kibbutzes and which used to be your villages, and in actual fact we'll rebuild your villages and then we'll go in and get Hamas.
Yeah,
but they didn't do that, did they?
I think that would have been a good way of
they could have done it.
There's something a little bit chummy about this thing with Cameron and Benjamin Netanyahu, which it does bother me. You know, after the cenotaph ceremony on Sunday a couple of weeks ago, on Remembrance Day, where they fail to remember anything, it seems to me. King Charles, Rishi Sunak and David Cameron walk from the cenotaph into the Foreign Office, and the next morning they announce Cameron is going to be the Foreign Secretary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very...
It's a clique.
It is a clique, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, he's not even an elected MP, and people rejected his foreign policy in the past, so...
Well, he's responsible for the destruction of Libya. Yeah. He was probably the primary person.
Yeah. Oh, indeed, yeah.
I'm just trying to get the name of this guy. IDF jets struck Nassim Abu Ajina, the commander of the Belt... Lahar Britannia of Hamas. Okay, this is the Hamas commander.
Yeah.
It's the tank commander that put the first shell into Kibbutz Berry. He's also died in the conflict. So, I mean, he admitted it. He said, "Well, this seemed a bit strange to me, but my commander said to me just start putting tank shells into the kibbutz."
Well, there are bigger questions about how they got through the border. And whether we've now got a Western flotilla in the Mediterranean. I think historians will look at this and will say, hang on a minute, they started moving those aircraft carriers into position before Hamas carried out the strike.
Indeed, yeah.
Now, that suggests to me, and of course, if I can work this out, the Russian general staff can work this out, because this is one of the fronts in World War III.
Anyway, look, we've just had Lord Cameron. We've got to have his buddy too, BB.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for coming here and standing with us. Well, we hope to get our hostages out. It's not without its challenges, but we hope to get this first tranche out, and then we're committed to getting everyone out. But we'll continue with our war aims, namely to eradicate Hamas, because Hamas has already promised that they will do this again and again and again. They're a genocidal terrorist cult. There's no hope for peace between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and the Arab states, if we don't eradicate this murderous movement that threatens the future of all of us. I think it's a larger battle of civilization against barbarism, the kind of savagery that you saw on your visit. It's the worst savagery perpetrated on Jews since the Holocaust. And just as the world united to vanquish the Nazis or vanquish Al-Qaeda after 9/11 or vanquish ISIS, we have to unite to vanquish Hamas. Israel sustained proportionately 29/11s. 29/11s. It's as though 50,000 Americans were slaughtered on a single day and 10,000 were held hostage, including a 9-month-old baby. Mm-hmm. He can't walk, he can't talk, he's a hostage. I mean, what kind of people do this? And the answer is, these are not people, these are monsters. These monsters have to go, they'll go, we'll pursue the battle until that goal is achieved. And we give a different future for Gaza and for us.
He's the spokesperson for something. That's the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, back again, should be in prison, apparently, but he's changed the law so he doesn't have to go to jail for fraud. He's saying, Martin, threats, that Hamas is a threat to all of us. He's talking about the whole world, really. He's saying, look, you know, we are the front line. After they finish with us, they'll be coming for you if we allow them to get anywhere. He's also talking about civilization versus barbarism. Now, there does seem to be quite a lot of twisting things and lying going on here.
Well, to say the least, I mean, he brings up 9/11. The question is, who did 9/11? The Russian general staff know that as well, and they know the Israelis were involved. Yeah. It doesn't matter what we're saying in our alternative media universe. What matters is what the Iranian general staff think, what the Russian general staff think, and what the and things like this, the Chinese general staff. This is a part of World War III.
The South African general staff just expelled the Israeli diplomats from South Africa.
That's happening in Latin America as well.
But how barbaric is it for children to be underneath rubble, dying slowly, painfully, over a matter of days, maybe, without anybody rescuing them because they're not allowing anybody in to look through the rubble? I mean, how barbaric is that?
Well, you could turn up his rhetoric round the other way and say the state of Israel was founded on terror, it's a barbaric state, and it has to end. I mean, I think what's coming forward now is the two-state solution is over, because the Israelis have already said they don't want it. We're now talking about Algérie Française. Algérie Française doesn't exist anymore. Millions of French settlers settled in Algeria. They lived there for 123 years. They got very comfortable with the idea that Algeria was part of France. France was always going to be in Algeria. And then eventually, after a million people were killed, they all had to go somewhere else. And virtually everybody in Israel has actually got relatives somewhere else. And even the ones that were born there have got grandparents somewhere else. Yeah. Uri Avenry came from Germany. And, of course, lots of Jews came from Germany. Lots have come from Russia in recent years. They can go back there, can't they? What's the problem?
Apparently 30% of Israelis have got dual passports. And, of course, 20% then are Palestinians. Yeah. So what you're left with is only half of the population that either aren't indigenous people or aren't...
It's almost sort of above all of this is this concept that actually maybe Netanyahu and the greater Israel bloc in parliament now, this far-right people, maybe actually they are the biggest threat to Israel.
They are a big threat
to Jews, who they are, as we had Gideon Levy earlier saying, isn't it crazy? They're telling all the Jews to come here, and then they're saying, oh, we're about to be hit by a massive attack from Iran. In fact, Martin, isn't it right to say that the Arab countries have been actually very restrained over this massive genocide and massacre that's been going on over the last 6-7 weeks?
Well, some would say that they've been absolutely craven rather than restrained. They've basically just been cowardly. But I won't go there because it's not for me to say. I mean, I'm not in the position
What do you think, Judith?
Well, I think there's certain countries like Jordan that are vulnerable, and so therefore they're always going to toe the line because they live next to Israel and they're very vulnerable. But there are other countries. I think Israel just needs the money. But then there's other countries like the UAE now has diplomatic relationships with Israel, and they haven't withdrawn their ambassador. So I think there is a saying in the Arab world, which is rich Arabs have got the money and the power to do something, but they don't know what to do. And poor Arabs haven't got any money and haven't got any power, but they know exactly what to do. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one day when I was living in Yemen, I had to go along there's a big ring road, sort of, it takes 6 lanes of traffic or something in both directions, and it's around Sana'a. And one day I had to go out to an appointment, and then I sort of like I noticed this incredible the 60 meter road was absolutely blocked with people. It was just crammed with people. So I sort of thought, I said to somebody, what's going on? And they said, oh, it's the anniversary of the Nakba, and we're all out protesting about it. So, you know, there were so many people there, and I was just like quite amazed to see it. And I'm sure that there are crowds like that now, but they're the sort of the Arab in the street.
Well, maybe not, because just looking at antiwar.com, the Israeli security minister has banned any celebration of Palestinian prisoners being released.
Well, this is in Yemen.
Don't
run in Yemen.
No, he doesn't.
No.
And in fact, almost no one does run in Yemen. It's in little sort of warlord areas. But I think this is it's a sign really of what the Arab street thinks about.
They've lost the propaganda war absolutely decisively here. And they're very vulnerable. The Turks, for example, had just cut off their oil supply.
Yeah.
Erdogan talks a big talk, but if he's serious, and of course there is actually a Turkish flotilla heading for Gaza.
Yeah.
Yeah, with lots of humanitarian supplies on it.
Yeah, that's
are the Israelis going to sink that ship? Yeah. Those ships, because Turkey's a member of NATO. If those ships, which are under the Turkish flag, are sunk, then we're going to war with Israel. Maybe we should. We went to war with Serbia. Didn't we?
It's not an official Turkish military boat, is it? But anyway, before we cut, I said we're going to finish, but there's also Donald Trump to listen to here. He's a big fan of Israel, but he had a little bit of, this is one of his recent speeches. He's talking about the role of Israel in the 3rd of January 2020, just before the whole plandemic started kicking in, assassination of the leader of the Israeli Revolutionary Guard, who was a general, Soleimani.
Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
Iranian, didn't I say that?
You said Israeli.
Did I?
Yes.
Iranian, sorry. Revolutionary Guard, Soleimani. So this is where the Trump administration assassinated this Iranian general.
I stand with Israel 100%, and we will not let them fail. I did have a bad experience with Israel, though. When we took out Soleimani, it was us and Israel working as a group, and we knew where he was. We knew how he was coming in. We knew the plane. We knew everything. We worked on it for weeks, for months, actually. But we worked on it for weeks. And the night before, I don't think this has ever been told. They'll say, oh, it's classified information. Well, maybe it is, but I don't think so. The night before this happened, and by the way, Biden's got a lot of problem with those documents. He's moving them to Chinatown. He's moved them all over. I didn't. And I come under the Presidential Records Act. He doesn't. He doesn't, because he was vice president and he was a senator. As a senator, you're not allowed to do it. As a president, I am, because I come under the president. I can do whatever I want, but I did nothing wrong. And then they go after me, but they don't go after him. But we'll see what happens. But with all of the different things that happened, we took abuse like nobody, and we had to do this because we heard Soleimani was going to be blowing up five of our really big military bases in areas all over the Middle East. He was going to be blowing them up. He was a very bad guy, very smart guy, but very bad guy. He was the leader of their military for a long time. In fact, the Ayatollah, they were all afraid of him. I actually think they were happy when this happened, okay? I think they were happy. I remember the Prime Minister of Pakistan said to me, it was the biggest event in the history of the Middle East. This is big stuff. This was a big event. He said, I left my office, Khan, a very good man. He left his office. He said, I went home. This was the biggest event in my life. And he was a great cricket player. He was like the Willie Mays, the Mickey Mantle, the Babe Ruth of cricket. He was a great cricket player. He became handsome guy, great guy. He became the Prime Minister of Pakistan. He said, when I heard that he was dead, this was the biggest event I've ever seen, I've ever been involved in. And I left my office and I went home for 1 week and I contemplated. He said, I've never seen anything like it. It was big stuff. This was much bigger than anybody, but we had to do it. He was going to blow up our installations all over, kill many people, many, many people, and wounded people beyond recognition. And Israel was going to do this with us, and it was being planned and working on it for months, and now we had everything all set to go. And the night before it happened, I got a call that Israel will not be participating in this attack. Nobody's heard this story before, but I like to tell it to Club 47 because you've been so loyal and so beautiful. And I said, what does this mean? We're working on it with them. Why? They didn't tell us why, sir, but they're not doing it. This was a day before. I said, I don't like that. That's not good. I looked at one of my generals who's fantastic, a warrior. I'm telling you, we have unbelievable military, unbelievable warriors. Just not the guys you see on television. They're real stiffs, real dopes. But these guys are warriors. They don't want to be on television. They want to win fights, okay? They want to win battles. And I said to him, General, what do you want to do? Sir, we can do whatever you'd like to do, sir. We can finish it ourselves, sir, if you'd like. I said, well, do we need them? Not at all, sir. I said, so what do you want to do, General? Sir, we have it under control if you want to do it. If you don't want to do it, we understand. Whatever you say, sir, is okay with us. I said, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. Because what this guy did to our soldiers, what this guy did to so many people, including many civilians, including many of his own people, just blew them to pieces by the tens of thousands. Let's do it. And he came on the plane, and we followed him right from the Situation Room. We followed the whole thing, and about 15 seconds later, it was all over, and we did it. But I'll never forget that Bibi Netanyahu let us down. That was a very terrible thing, I will say that. And so when I see sometimes the intelligence, you talk about the intelligence, or you talk about some of the things that went wrong over the last week, they've got to straighten it out, because they're fighting potentially a very big force. They're fighting potentially Iran.
That very big force that is nuclear armed is actually Israel. What do you make of that account, both of you? Martin, maybe first.
Well, it's just self-seeking and sickening, really, isn't it? I mean, he didn't just kill Soleimani, of course. He killed various other militia leaders from Iraq, who are now, of course, involved in attacking the military bases in Iraq, which, of course, the Iraqi parliament has voted that they need to leave Iraq. And, of course, he's the president of the United States. When Gavril Princip assassinated the Archduke Ferdinand in 1914, he was a 19-year-old young terrorist working with the Serbian Black Hand intelligence agencies. And it caused a major conflagration. Just one 19-year-old kid. This guy's the most powerful man in the world. How is it you can say that I'm going to knock down a sovereign country's top general and then expect that they're not going to react?
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to react. They have reacted. Mm. And, of course, it could have turned into a world war right there and then. And if he gets his finger anywhere near the nuclear button, you can be quite sure we'll be counting
every
day.
Well, he has had it near the nuclear button, hasn't he?
I know. And he nearly pushed us over the edge there with that reckless act. And, of course, when he says the Israelis didn't let him, the Israelis put him up to it. And then, of course, they cannily said, well, you do it, and we'll just pretend we had nothing to do with it. And he went along with it. What he should have said to the Israelis, we don't do stuff like that.
And also, show us the evidence. We don't believe you.
Show us the evidence.
Yes, of course, Soleimani was on his way to Saudi Arabia. That's why he's on a civilian plane. He's on his way to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Saudis about exactly the kind of deal that
I seem to remember we reported this on this at the time, that the few weeks later, the ground commander for the United States in that part of the world, I'm not sure whether it was in Iraq or wherever, was killed in a plane crash. He was flying to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Now, of course,
it was an Afghan commander. I'm not sure, but anyway.
It was the guy that the Iranians identified as the person who gave the order from Trump. They killed him. But that doesn't mean much, because, of course, nobody heard about that.
Yeah.
The point is, it's totally irresponsible. Somebody like Trump carrying out an act like that, what the Iranians then did is they attacked the base in Kurdistan, and they told the Americans, get into your air raid shelters, we're going to attack you, which they did, and then they stopped. But what they could have done is attacked every US base in the Middle East. The US bases in the Middle East are, in fact, a complete sitting ducks, as are their fleet. If it comes to a war, they're going to lose. The Israelis are going to lose as well.
because in actual fact the balance of power has shifted against them. The Russians are the best army on the planet and the Iranians are pretty close.
Well, they certainly seem to have built up the ability to fight the Americans quietly over the years.
I think that the BRICS BRICS Plus now is must be sort of worrying the American, because it's not so much sort of war, but it's economic and
but
war.
What bothers me, Judith, is that they don't actually care, because they actually want a war.
Yeah,
they're not entirely rational. That's the scary thing.
I mean, you know, it's like, oh, we need to just mow the lawn of humanity every once in a while. I met people in the military who were had that attitude. You know, it's just oh, we need a cull every once in a while. Let's do it. I'm afraid that's one of the just and of course this is the ordo ab chao attitude. You create chaos and then you get more powerful in the outcome. But the last person we're going to hear from tonight, it's not quite as long as Donald Trump, is the boss. And he's somebody who you often hear lots and lots of criticism of the United Nations. And, of course, you were working with them yourselves, Judith. I mean, I see a lot of people say, oh, the UN are evil. Well, World Health Organization, pretty awful. Can we square that circle? Because actually the UN have been pretty good in Gaza, it seems to me, certainly making the right kind of noises about the Israelis and standing up to them.
Well, I haven't actually read anything about the UN policy recently.
Well, you know the WHO, and you've been watching. Yeah. I mean, what do you make of the UN?
I don't hold them in high regard. They take an awful lot of money and do not very much. They're a sort of a paid organisation, I think the world would go on just as well without them.
Well, you see if you agree when you've finished hearing from the boss. Mm. He's the Secretary General Guterres this week. Mm.
I've been very clear in denouncing the violations of international humanitarian law and the violations of protection of civilians. And I have not a mandate to classify the acts. There are entities that have that mandate. But I think that more important than a discussion on names is the facts. And let's see the facts. As you know, we report every year on children killed in armed conflict by different actors. I have already presented 7 reports. In the 7 reports, the highest number of children killed in 1 year by one actor was by the Taliban in the 2017-2018. The second by the Syrian government and its allies in, before 2020, and again it was around 700. We have had Russia last year, 350. We had Saudi Arabia, if you remember the uproar in relation to Yemen. In 1 year, the maximum, 300. Now, without entering into discussing the accuracy of the numbers that were published by the de facto authorities in Gaza, what is clear is that we have had, in a few weeks, thousands of children killed. So, this is what matters. We are witnessing a killing of civilians that is unparalleled and unprecedented in any conflict since I am Secretary General.
Well, he's being pretty forceful there, isn't he? I mean, just before the pandemic, we had some clips from this documentary that was made by the Swedish state broadcaster called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, which looked at the assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld back, I think it was 1963. I mean, when the UN started, it was supposed to be something where the Secretary General took quite a strong role in going around speaking to people around the world, and also was backed by some military force on certain occasions. Once he had been assassinated, all the sort of steam seemed to go out of the UN.
What year was that, Tony?
63, I think.
I think that, my opinion is that people have are elected to the UN and work in different positions. The heads of the UN in each country always come from another country, usually Europe or America. And the local people don't have much say, and yet it's the local people who know what's going on. And
well, they've had a special rapporteur in Britain, haven't they? Being very, very critical of the British, and it's good that they're not, in a way, a Brit.
Yeah, yes, they've. I mean, the special rapporteur in from Yemen, actually, his personal statement was especially the first one that was there at the beginning of the war. His statements were really spot on. So there are individual people who say the right thing at the right time. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, and I think this speech was excellent. But what power do they have to change things?
It's a bit like the EU, isn't it? Like a kind of talking shop, really.
Yeah, it is.
A bit
yeah.
like this show.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think that you're paid as much as the UN officials. And certainly, I mean, my experience in Yemen was that sometimes they made sort of. I was in charge of the healthcare there in their program for caring for refugees, and sometimes they made decisions which I just knew that once they'd made. Sometimes they didn't even tell us that they'd made a decision about healthcare, and then we found out because refugees turned up sort of making these particular claims, and sometimes they were just absolutely ridiculous decisions. Like, for example, they decided that unregistered refugees could have free healthcare. So what happened? Refugees who were pregnant were selling their urine so that they could have a positive pregnancy test, so that all the refugees who weren't registered could have free healthcare. We knew that it was a chaotic decision, and in fact, it ended up with a crowd of people attacking the UN office in Sana'a, and it was put out of action for some time as a result of that, because obviously they had to withdraw it at some point.
In Africa, we've had quite a lot of UN officials being kicked out of African countries because they are trying to stop the those African nations booting out the colonial powers and allowing the Chinese and the Russians to come anyway. Look, you know a bit about health.
Yeah.
The tech giant started by a US billionaire has clinched a £480 million deal to handle NHS patient information.
Palantir.
That's it, Palantir. Yeah. Peter Thiel's little plaything.
Yeah.
This is going to be a little bit, well, what do you make of it? Because it's like Bilderberg.
Terrifying. And I think that the difficulty is that they give this money, and they then have the say in how particularly primary healthcare is going to go in UK, because I think this is to do with mostly doctor's surgeries, isn't it?
I mean, we've all signed these things saying, no, we don't want our digital information to go anywhere. Of course, Palantir are going to be flogging it on the open market.
Yeah.
But also in the UN, and Bill Gates have launched something called the 50 in 5 Global Digital Infrastructure Plan. The UN Development Programme has officially launched their new initiative promoting digital public infrastructure all over the world. The 50 in 5 programme, so-called, because it aims to introduce DPI, that's some sort of digital identity, in 50 countries in the next 5 years, began with a live streamed event on November the 8th. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page too. But this just sounds as if these are the people that are managing the world. We're about to hear from Jungle Bus Millie about the Dutch elections, that actually it was Microsoft that have helped fund a lot of these far-right parties. Anyway, what's the best way to follow your work? This report you've been talking about today about fake news.
At the moment, Tony, I can't, but what I'm thinking of doing is starting a Substack, because I've at Panda, it takes absolutely ages to get anything published. So I'm thinking of starting a Substack and putting it on there, and when I put all my stuff on Substack, I'll give you the contact details.
Yeah, you do that. Yeah. Thanks ever so much for joining us. We're going to go now and have a look at Argentina, which has now got a far-right Javier Milei, who's an anarcho-capitalist, running the country.
He has been a staunch critic of President Alberto Fernández's handling of the economy. But on Tuesday, far-right elected President Javier Milei visited Fernández at the official residence to begin discussing the transition. The journey was televised on national television. Milei met with Fernandez for a few hours. It was supposed to bring confidence to a country that many say has jumped into the unknown.
Javier Milei is using this hotel as his headquarters until he takes office on December 10th. There's lots of uncertainty about how he's going to carry out the radical reforms to transform Argentina's economy. But there's also lots of questions about how to keep the economy operating during the transition.
Argentina's economy is struggling with soaring inflation. The peso is tied to the US dollar. There are several exchange rates and the government imposes strict currency controls. Milei has promised to lift those controls, shut down the central bank, and dollarize the economy. On Tuesday, Argentina's peso lost 10% in the parallel markets, and many fear it could get worse in the lead-up to Inauguration Day.
I'm quite uncertain and afraid. The truth is that this man did not offer anything. He was not very clear with his proposals. Well, he was clear with his proposals, but not in the way he wants to implement them.
Economists say he will have to build alliances in order to carry out his reforms.
How can you push that through a system where he only has, I mean, he has no governors. Out of our 24 governors, he has zero. He has 38 congressmen and he has seven senators. So he has to find some kind of partners.
Milei won with over 55% of the votes, a figure that gives legitimacy to carry out reforms. Many are desperate for economic stability in Argentina, a country where inflation has been a problem for far too long. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
CIA, anarcho-capitalists, they're turning over, the getting rid of the peso, and they want to have the US dollar running the country?
Yeah, well, I mean, Argentina has obviously had a crisis running for many, many years, which is presented as if the Argentinians go, what, they just can't manage their own affairs. The real problem in Argentina is international debt. The oligarchy in Argentina, when they were a military dictatorship, took out loads of loans, which they used to repress the population. And then when the population eventually gets a democracy in the 1980s, they have to pay the debts that the oligarchy has run up. And Michael Hudson is very good about this. The actual Argentinian national debt is owed to the Argentinian oligarchy. So it's their money that they own. They own the Argentinian national debt, and by getting rid of the peso and bringing in the dollar, that means that their personal fortunes will be preserved while the population is put to the sword. Now, Argentina has also got quite a big history of popular uprisings, and I suspect that this guy, he's got 54% of the vote. Once he starts taking away people's food and food subsidies and so on, they're going to revolt against him.
Yeah, so it's like a recipe for civil war.
Well, that's right. It is a civil war, isn't it? Let's say it's a class war, which is a civil war.
Well, well done, CIA. And what's it called? Americom, who are the American military that run all that problem. Yeah, listen, Martin, we've got to get on to the Dutch election this week as well. And so I got hold of Jungle Bus Millie down in Exeter, who's is a former mainstream media journalist over there. So she gave us a really good roundup. Nothing far better than anything I've heard anywhere else on Geert Wilders, who's just, it seems, taken over. In fact, he's going to get the first chance to start a coalition. And you're not going to like this, Martin, because she explains just what a disaster the proportional representation system is over in Holland.
I'm just reading that close to 80% of the Dutch went and voted. That is massive, I think, in the UK. Normally you barely make 50, don't you? Yeah, 80%, 78.2%. The guy who's won, he's the guy with the dyed hair. He's often likened to Hitler. He's a very strange character. He's himself married to a Hungarian woman, but absolutely hates immigrants. Out of 150 seats in the Dutch lower house, he's won 37. He was predicted to get around about 25, so that would be 1/6. So 15% of the vote. He used to just have one or two seats, but he used to always, in this horrendous system that is proportional representation, he used to make up the majority. So the right-wing party, VVD, that was Mark Rutte's party, who are now completely disgraced and almost well, close to wiped out is an overstatement, but you know, they've lost big time. Especially if you look at the map, on the map they indicate blue for Wilders, or you know, different colours for different parties, and the Vevede are just nowhere to be seen, a couple of strongholds. So anyway, in this proportional representation, the VVD and Christian Democrats, they tended to be the two ruling parties, but they never actually had the 75 seats. Or they would maybe together make it to 74 seats, but obviously they needed 76 to have a majority in the lower house. So they would invite this Wilders guy, or the Christian Union, which was even worse, fundamentalist Christians in the Dutch government, to make up the numbers. And then, of course, people think PR is a brilliant idea. But the party, the smallest party, holds the balance of power, because if they say we don't like what you're doing, we don't like that you're not actually carrying out our manifesto, you just do as you please, but hang on a minute, we've got a say in this. And if they walk out, the government crashes over one or two seats out of 150. So it's completely anti-democratic. It's not more democratic. It's completely anti-democratic that the smallest party blackmails an entire country. So that he has now got 37 seats. Another party, which is called NSC, who are also very right-wing, was born out of the whole child tax credit scandal. The new social contract, NSC, they also won a fair number of seats. This is a really new party, and it was born from the child tax credit scandal that caused the entire Rutte government to resign, I think, 2 years ago, and then miraculously they were back again. But he is basically a stickler for the constitution and for the rule of law, whereas Wilders is anything but. He has been trying for the last 20 years, he's been trying actively to create a two-tier citizenship basis for anyone who's not, well, white and blue-eyed, basically, who's not Aryan, shall we say, called a creature by its name. So all immigrants will be second-rate citizens, yeah, based on their origin and their creed. And then particularly Muslim, of course, not the expats. Heaven forbid anybody says anything about, or the Chinese. No, the Muslims. So this is completely unconstitutional. But he's apparently said, after the results of the elections became known, he said he is willing. Oh, my God, the gesture, you know, the grandiose gesture. He is willing to uphold the constitution. Like, what is that even? What mentality does it require to do that? I don't understand. The bottom line of the elections is that nobody on the left, but nobody on the left, is willing to create a coalition with this man because he's so odious. He's anti-Europe, which is, sorry, not anti-Europe, anti-EU, as am I. But many Dutch people are, obviously, Holland was at the cradle of the Benelux. Benelux, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg. So the Dutch are overwhelmingly pro-EU. Then he's anti-immigration, which is very difficult because Holland actively invited Turkish and Moroccan immigrants back in the 70s. To come and work in their tomato and flower greenhouses and bulb fields and what have you. And then were highly surprised when these people said, oh, life's good here, I think I'll stay. So I think 2004, I translated a PhD from Dutch into English, and it was about the rise of the extreme right wing all over Europe, including Britain, UKIP, and Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, who was murdered. The rise of the extreme right wing, and especially the financing of the extreme right wing. And if you had to take who supplied the money for these people, I will tell you, it was Pfizer and it was Microsoft. Big sums of money to all the extreme right-wing parties. So for someone who's anti-globalization, to actually, it came via the Edmund Burke Foundation, which is a very questionable institution, one of these many shady NGOs. So anyway, no one on the left will want to govern with this man. So it looks like it'll be an extreme right wing coalition. So PVV won the 37 seats. So then that new social contract, who are basically saying, you know, the politics as we've had it for the last 20 years is completely dead. We need a new kind of politics with much more respect for the citizen and much more respect for the rule of law. They have 20 seats. The Christian Democrats, who were always the biggest party in Holland, always, they are now reduced to a mere 5 seats. And then the VVD, which is like the moderate conservatives, if you like, they have 24. And the farmers have 7 seats. So there you go.
Thanks very much for that brilliant little report, Millie. Martin, I think we can just put to one side this business of whether proportional representation. It's almost like there's a recipe for disaster there, that this government isn't going to last long. Whatever he puts together, it's going to fall out pretty soon, isn't it?
Well, that's the beauty of PR, is in actual fact, it's very tricky game. It's a very tricky game of association football.
You end up with no government.
Well, yes, you do, because that, in actual fact, the society is divided.
And a similar thing in Israel, didn't they? Yes. For years,
but if the society...
Months of no government at all. So maybe that's good for the corporations. It's certainly not good for the people.
No, but you could have a situation where you've got... Under first past the post, what frequently happens is the people who've got less votes end up running the country so that the majority are disenfranchised. How can that be right?
Okay.
So all that supportive representation does, it means you've got a proper game of football. You've still got to win the game. If enough people in Holland want to vote for his ideas... then that's the way it'll go. And that's the fault of the people who vote for him and what they believe in.
No, it isn't. It's the fault of the press that spins it.
Ah, well, yeah. Of course, it's also to do with that. But, of course, you've got to treat adults as adults. And if what can often happen with it, Meloni is now in charge in Italy. She's from a fascist background. Movimento Sociale Italiano was a fascist party. They still see Mussolini as a hero. She's running the country. But you know what? She's going to crash and burn because the crisis isn't going to be solved by people like that.
In a way, the real interesting thing about that excellent, superb report, I have to say, from someone you could tell kind of missed their vocation as a journalist. I mean, she's done a superb job there. He's talking about Pfizer and Microsoft funding these whole far right movement through the Edmund Burke Foundation.
Used to be the MP for Bristol.
Yeah, so they're taking the Mickey, aren't they? I know. Let's set up a far right foundation which is going to turn all these far right parties in, put them all into government right across Europe, and let's name them after somebody who was a brilliant anti-slavery campaigner, etc.
Yes, and also the other thing is that they fund everything, okay?
Occupying our space.
Yeah. So what they do is they fund the far right.
This is a free speech, wasn't
it? They fund the far right and give them and then they can say, oh yes, but Wilders, he's a terrible person, and then therefore you've got to support Pfizer, Microsoft, because we're against far right things. You know, I mean.
They're controlling both sides of the chessboard.
That's right. That's the whole point of it. And of course, by keeping everybody on the, you know, arguing, we're about to have a nuclear war, folks, and we're having an argument about one of Wilders' is campaigns is to ban the Quran in Holland. It's like, you can't ban a book that's read by billions of people. How will you enforce that? You're going to go to shops and burn the Quran in all the shops? Now, you can see these people will get... This guy in Argentina is now in power. He'll do an awful lot of damage, but he won't be able to run Argentina because they can't. They don't know how.
Final, before we get to the end, what would a third world war mean for investors? In The Economist is looking at global conflicts have a habit of sneaking up on money managers. So that kind of perfect for your little. I mean, you can't read this, of course, because the Economist Rothschild paper is, which. Really, I suppose, I mean, the idea here is to sort of steer, it's kind of insider dealing, you know, you all get a bit of information here, but they're just trying to steer your head into a little ostrich hole. And anyway, so what do you make of, is it going to be good for investors?
Well, for the, a sort of slow burn World War III, which is what we've had in the last couple of decades, is quite good for some investors in stocks like military stocks. Lockheed Martin, BA Systems and so on have been doing very well out of the recent social, you know, economic and military crisis.
They will be making a fortune, folks, yes, they because will. They will know when things are about to happen.
And of course, and it's money for old rope, because in actual fact, it's just government spending on now, military. If you don't have to invent anything clever, you just have to take the money.
If you go back to 9/11, if you remember, there were all sorts of funny put options. So indeed. If someone was really smart, I don't know if anybody is out there, you could be taking a very close look at what money is being put on put options and derivatives to bet on commodities going up or down, shares going up or down, this sort of thing. And if you get a load of people betting on, it's a bit like roulette, isn't it? If you get loads of people betting on X, then you know that one is likely to come up. In fact, it's not like roulette, really, roulette involves chance.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, that's the beauty of it from the point of view of established oligarchies, because there's no chance involved in making money out of supplying weapons to the government. And it's money for old rope. And, you know, it saves you having to do the work of thinking of really useful products that people might actually want to buy.
Another thing I'd like to just mention before we go is Germany, because there's been a lot of protesters arrested in Germany. They've been banning protests in Germany. They seem to be very, very close to the Israelis, Martin.
Well, that's right, because, you know, what is happening all over the world is the return of the repressed, is all sorts of things that have been repressed for years and years and years, and everybody thought they'd all gone away. They're just coming back like a nightmare, and we're not going to wake up because it's real.
Mass arrests following a pro-Palestinian rally in Berlin. Plus, we've also had another load of arrests this week of this Reichsbürger movement. The police officers in Germany have searched the homes of 20 people yesterday in connection with investigations into the far-right Reichsbürger, or the Reich Citizens Movement. They've been accused apparently of plotting to kidnap the health minister in Germany, for example, over COVID. But there's quite obviously a kickback against this new fascism, and people are joining this movement and are being targeted. But the thing is it a genuine movement, or is this again some sort of controlled opposition?
It's a strategy of tension. That's what it is. You create as much political polarisation as possible so that you can then manipulate the outcomes. And the NATO intelligence services will be behind all of this.
Maybe they're right in saying that this group, in saying that the present government is destabilising Germany and accusing us of destabilising Germany. Actually, it's the government that is.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you've got in Germany is an enforced ordo-liberalism, as they call it. So the far right is supposedly completely no, we can't have any swastikas, anything like that. But the far left are also tarred with the same brush. So Sarah Wagenknecht, who started her own party, she's opposed to the war in Ukraine, as are most German citizens. But the government doesn't reflect that, because it's actually run by the Brits and the Americans, which is why nobody's complained about us blowing up their pipeline. Because that's the Russians suspect that the British were involved in that.
Have you ever come across someone called Laura Eboli? Yeah, she's a bit of a glamour model, but she's got a few things to say, our final item tonight, about transhumanism, the end game.
They created an artificial neural network of 1.73 billion nerve cells connected by 10.4 trillion synapses. Sounds very impressive, but actually it's only a fraction of every human being's nerve cells. Scientists believe we all carry between 80 and 100 billion nerve cells, or about as many stars, in the Milky Way. The researchers were actually not able to simulate the human's brain activity in real time, and it took 40 minutes with a combined muscle of 82,944 processors to get just 1 second of biological brain processing time. But they want to think, they want to make you think you're useless. They don't want to make you better. They don't want to make you a superhuman. The end game is to make you a totally controllable piece of machinery. Another thing in the Internet of Things. As Klaus Schwab has said on numerous occasions, the fourth industrial revolution will not change the world. It will change you. They will entice you with promises of immortality, but it's digital immortality. They will try to convince you of a life without disease and suffering, but by disconnecting you from the natural web of life and connecting you to the grid. And they will speak of becoming gods, homo deus, in the words of Mr. Harari. Well, we once took a bite of that apple, and we fell. And we've been falling ever since. But I think we now have a chance to redeem ourselves. We now have a chance to change our ways, to understand our foolishness, to see where we went wrong, a chance to walk in the right direction with appreciation, with humility, with courage, with truth, with faith, and with love. Let's not take this chance to transform ourselves to something different, but to become the best version of ourselves. We are not here to become God. We are here for God to experience life through us. Thank you.
That's Laura Aboli there. Not bad. We had quite a lot of chat in the first part of the show about our mayor, and I was ticked off by Patrizia Opulenta this week for neglecting to read out her mayor's poem. Here it is, Ode to Marvin Rees, What's Going On? Marvin Rees, what's going on in Bristol at your hands? The high life you're dreaming, yet never take a stand in favour of those living in the city that you live. All it seems you ever do is take and never give. It's likely you spend hours getting ready for the day, flying to New York for a 14-minute say, in love with your publicity, but reporters, it seems, are banned from meetings, asking questions. Oh, Marvin, be a man. High-rise blocks he's fond of, no discussion will allow. His inner circle all chosen to scrape to him and bow. Achievements he has listed 100, so he claims. Heard it through the grapevine, it's all a word, soup game. Statue Wars, a film starring Marvin Rees to play. The role of local hero to camera. Watch him say, lighting and his makeup, suits and all his scripts. One-sided talk from Marvin, but democracy has slipped. Hubris, a heavy cloak he wears most every day. PR tool expensive to keep the truth at bay. BLM, a baton, now statues on the floor, a cause for him now thrives on, signs left up, and more. A pay rise rumoured taken when everyone locked down, religion uses oddly, perhaps, a devil's crown. It's said he's a bully, will not allow debate, inner circle sycophants, while those outside he hates. Narcissist is armour, to shirt tails hangs on tight, ain't no mountains high enough to climb and say you're right. Friends, a social climber in high places thinks he's found. One day hot air will all escape and come crashing to the ground. Well, thank you very much for that, Patrizia. And yes, it was very bad of me not to notice that one and use it on our show, because it's I think would have been a little bit hot to handle in the middle of George Ferguson and Sister Nuani earlier on. I'm not sure they would have quite sat comfortably with them, but certainly we have a few problems with our mayor. Time to sign off now. Thanks with our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Judith Brown. Dr. Judith Brown, you just heard there, researcher, former medical worker for the UN in Yemen. Also to Sister Nuani and to former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. And also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips one way or another, actually on the Tony
Tony Gosling Censored is one way to do that, via not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Two books up there available through eBay. One is The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group Origins. And the other one is Secret Government's anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination. That's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price.
I feel a bit bad because the Astrolasia put lots of good records and I never seem to get around to playing them because, frankly, they're too long. I know that's a ludicrous reason for not playing them, but it's the reason that I have to give. This is from the LP on Magic Eye Records called The Space Between.
I have come to show you.
Oh, yeah? He's going to speak again, isn't he?
No. I have come to show you.
This is Afterlife. Well, I've just spoken rather inadvertently to them on the phone, and they're all ready to go there in foreign parts. On Magic Eye Records from the LP The Space Between, this is Astralasia and Afterlife. Don't forget, tomorrow night between 8 and 10 on Radio 1, it's Guided by Voices in session on the programme. And now, as we've been threatening to do all afternoon, we go live to Ibiza. Here's Danny Rampling.